this for?
The Lucan Obsession with me, Alex von Tunzelman, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45.
On 92 to 95 FM and on BBC Sounds, this is Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 25th of October. This is Today with Justin Webb in the studio in London and Nick Robinson in Ipswich.
The headlines this morning: a BBC investigation has found evidence of the scale of cross-channel people smuggling, with criminals using warehouses in Germany to store boats.
They tell me the equipment comes from Turkey. They have about 10 warehouses around Essen. Police raided one a few days ago, but they separate their stock and give the bait to police.
We'll get a reaction from Germany and find out how what's happening there impacts small boat crossings across the Channel. And one other headline: the King has acknowledged what he called the Commonwealth's painful history at the formal opening of the organisation's summit in Samoa.
Also in today's programme, a day after the Chancellor signalled she's ready to borrow more to get Britain building in next week's budget, I've been taking a look at the NIMBY challenge that ministers will face, from those who say they do want new houses, but not in my backyard.
The mood at the Labour conference seemed to be that the Labour YIMBY crowd was there, and it was very much a pro-housing sense. Locally, there tends to be more votes, in my experience, in opposing housing, or opposing anything indeed.
And an exclusive interview with Kate Bush, who's been talking to Emma about her new short animated film, and has a big music revelation too.
I'm very keen to start working on a new album when I've got this finished. I've got lots of ideas. I'm really looking forward to getting back into that creative space. It's been a long time.
There'll be guests across the country. More from Kate throughout the programme. The BBC News is read this morning by Tom Sanders.
An investigation by BBC News has found evidence that small inflatable boats used to ferry migrants across the Channel are being hidden in warehouses in western Germany. An undercover reporter was told by criminals that the equipment was being stored in multiple sites in the city of Essen. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
This year has already become the deadliest for migrant crossings on the English Channel, according to a United Nations agency. The supply line for these boats stretches far back into Europe. Our undercover journalist, who posed as a Syrian man hoping to get to Britain, met and exchanged messages with two smugglers in the West German city of Essen. They offered him a deal, €15,000 for a dinghy, engine and 60 life jackets to be delivered to the Calais area. They told him they had about 10 warehouses around Essen storing equipment that had come via Turkey. Britain's National Crime Agency says Germany's become a central location for the storage of small boats. Cities like Essen are close, but not too close, to northern France's more heavily monitored beaches. The German and UK governments say cooperation to crack down on the gangs behind this trade is good or accelerating.
The King has urged Commonwealth countries to commit to learning the lessons of the past at the opening of a meeting of the organisation's leaders in Samoa. Some members of the 56-nation group, made up mainly of former British colonies, want a discussion about reparations for slavery. King Charles, who's head of the Commonwealth, didn't directly reference the matter in his speech, but said it was time to find creative ways to right inequalities that endure. The government has rejected suggestions the UK should pay reparations. Our correspondent Katie Watson reports from Samoa.
King Charles told the Commonwealth leaders that it was vital to understand the group's history. I understand, he said, from listening to people, how the most painful aspects of our past continue to resonate. Where inequalities exist, we must find the right ways and the right language to address them. There are growing calls for the UK to address the issue of reparatory justice over the transatlantic slave trade. The government said it won't be apologising or considering financial reparations, but other Commonwealth nations want to start the conversation. King Charles also spoke about climate change. We are all well past believing it is a problem for the future, he said. If the issue isn't addressed, then inequalities across the Commonwealth and beyond will only be exacerbated, with the potential to fuel division and conflict.
Efforts are being made to restart negotiations on a ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. US and Israeli officials are set to head to Qatar for talks this weekend. In northern Gaza, dozens of people are said to have been killed or wounded in the latest Israeli airstrikes. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
Local rescuers say 11 residential buildings were bombed in Jabalia refugee camp, where they believe there are some 150 casualties. It's become increasingly difficult to verify information from the area, which has been besieged by Israeli forces. Israel's military says its offensive in northern Gaza aims to stop Hamas fighters from regrouping. In a separate development, last night the Israeli army said it had killed a Hamas commander who took part in the deadly 7th of October attacks, identifying him as an employee of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA confirmed he was a staff member. As the war rages on, there are renewed efforts to restart ceasefire and hostage release talks. Israel says it's sending the head of its Mossad intelligence agency to Doha on Sunday to meet the CIA director and Qatar's prime minister. Hamas says there's been no change in its conditions for a deal.
A judge in California will rule on whether to release two brothers, Eric and Lyle Menendez, who've served more than three decades in jail for murdering their parents. They alleged that their father, a media executive, had sexually abused them, and their first trial in the mid-1990s attracted media attention across the US. Prosecutors have now asked the courts to re-sentence the pair, raising the possibility they could be freed on parole. The NHS regulator says many children and young people in England are struggling to get the mental health support they need. The Care Quality Commission cites rising demand and staff shortages. Ministers say the problems identified by the CQC reflect the appalling legacy the government inherited. Here's our Social Affairs editor, Alison Holt.
The Care Quality Commission's annual assessment of the state of the health and care system in England says the number of new requests for council care is rising, but more people are being turned down. It's particularly concerned about children and young people's mental health services, saying in 2023 an estimated one in five 8 to 25-year-olds had a mental illness. It points to problems recruiting psychiatrists, psychologists and nurses. The CQC says mental health difficulties in adults often start in childhood, so a lack of early support creates problems for the future.
Kate Bush has told this programme she's really ready to do something new 13 years after her last studio album. In a rare interview to mark the release today of an animation she's helped create for the charity War Child, the singer-songwriter says she has plenty of ideas. Our arts correspondent David Sillitoe has been listening.
I was born.
Set to Kate Bush's Snowflake, Little Shrew was created to highlight the impact of war on children.
In a cloud.
The song is from her last album, released 13 years ago. But speaking to Emma Barnett, she says she now feels ready to return to the studio.
I'm very keen to start working on a new album when I've got this finished. I've got lots of ideas. I'm really looking forward to getting back into that creative space. It's been a long time.
However, 10 years after her last live performance, when asked about returning to the stage, she said she wasn't there yet.
David Sillitoe reporting.
Thank you. 8 minutes past six. To the weather. Simon King brings it to us this morning. Morning, Simon.
Hello, Justin. Good morning. We've got some rain this morning in southwest England and across Wales. That rain is going to move its way gradually north and eastwards, so clearing across these many parts. But as it clears, there'll be some sunny spells and showers moving in from the southwest with a rather blustery south or southwesterly wind. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 14 to 16 degrees. In southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, we've got some mist and fog out there this morning. That's going to clear, but it will be a fairly cloudy day for most. We'll see a little bit of rain moving its way into the Midlands and parts of the southeast of England. Otherwise, though, it's going to be dry. And then very late in the day, there'll be some sunshine and some clearer skies developing, with temperatures getting to 16 to 20 Celsius. It can feel pretty mild once again for the time of year. Across northern England, quite cloudy with some very patchy rain across Merseyside and the Lake District. It's going to stay pretty overcast today, and there'll be quite a bit of clouds just breaking up a little bit in the northwest of England to give some brightness. Temperatures of 14 to 17 degrees. For Northern Ireland, it's a wet start today. The rain will ease off and becomes largely dry but overcast for the afternoon. Highs of 14 or 15 degrees. And for Scotland today, mostly cloudy with some light rain in the northwest. We could see a little bit of light rain elsewhere across Scotland, but it's going to be largely dry but pretty cloudy with temperatures about 11 to 14 degrees.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. Beautiful day here at East Anglia yesterday when I arrived. It's now 9 minutes past six. Time for our first look at the morning papers and what's on the news websites. Too much is made of the Chancellor's decision to change how debt is calculated. We'll be talking to a Treasury Minister about that later in the programme. The Daily Telegraph reports that the measure will unleash a borrowing spree of up to £50 billion. The Mail says that equates to £1,750 per household. The Shadow Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, is quoted as saying that Rachel Reeves' plans risk pushing up interest rates and punishing families with mortgages. Writing the Financial Times, Ms. Reeves says guardrails will be in place to ensure prudent spending.
There's also a warning for Rachel Reeves at the prospect of imposing national insurance on employers' pension contributions, a policy that could raise £15 billion. In a letter to The Times, the former Home Secretary and Work and Pension Secretary, Lord Blunkett, describes the potential measure as very worrying because it could lead to employers reducing pension contributions. That would come at a time when the government's own figures show 4 in 10 private sector workers are not saving enough for an adequate income in retirement. And we'll be hearing from Lord Blunkett at 8:30.
The proposed ban on smoking in pub gardens is, according to The Sun, running out of puff and on the verge of being dropped. The paper says smoking is now only to be prohibited outside schools and hospitals. The Guardian reports that there was fierce opposition from the hospitality trade. Number 10 officials also privately believe banning people from lighting up in pub gardens is an unserious policy and not backed by good evidence to show that non-smokers are harmed.
Time to listen is the message from the Daily Mirror on the subject of the UK paying reparations for its role in the slave trade, but the Daily Telegraph says there's no case for Britain to answer. Such demands for cash stand on shaky moral ground. The Mail's editorial takes aim at the Prime Minister's handling of the row. It says canny politicians from elsewhere in the Commonwealth, who are astute at spotting the weakest link, appear to have outsmarted him by securing a debate on reparations.
An investigation by The Express has found online fraudsters are ripping off the Royal British Legion's annual appeal by selling thousands of pounds worth of fake poppies. One website reportedly bragged that its produce was suitable for Remembrance Day activities to honour the lives and memories of fallen soldiers. The Shadow Defence Secretary James Cartledge has described the rip-off merchants as disgraceful. The Royal British Legion has urged people to only buy poppies from its trusted sellers.
And The Sun's lead says a nuclear submarine ran so low on food during a six-month patrol that sailors were ordered to share rations. The crew reportedly divvied up sweets and hunted for leftovers. Off-duty sailors were also urged to sleep to save energy. Its headline makes a pun on the title of the popular Sean Connery film, The Hunt for Bread October. Royal Navy spokesman is quoted as saying, "Every submariner receives a nutritionally balanced diet at all times."
Yeah, that's why they have press officers, isn't it? It is 12 minutes past six. All true, of course. I didn't mean to suggest anything else. 12 minutes past six. The King has urged Commonwealth leaders meeting in summer to commit to learning the lessons of the past.
I understand from listening to people across the Commonwealth how the most painful aspects of our past continue to resonate. It is vital, therefore, that we understand our history to guide us to make the right choices in the future.
Carefully choosing his words, listening to them at what's called CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Summer, is our correspondent Katie Watson. I suspect there was a lot of head scratches. They tried to work out exactly what the monarch was and was not saying there, Katie.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, like the UK has made it very clear, as we've heard, there's no apology, no discussion about reparations. The King obviously can't say anything, but he's been on this tour, first in Australia, now here in Samoa. And as he mentioned there, he's been talking to people, he's been listening to people, and he's, you know, clearly understands that these issues do continue. But, you know, he talked about this idea of helping to where the inequalities still exist. You have to find the right ways, the right language to address them. And he said, you can't change the past. We can commit, though, to finding creative ways to right inequalities that endure. So I'm sure he's going to leave that up to the politicians to work out what those creative ways are. But certainly, you know, he's wrapping up his state visit to Commonwealth countries with his thoughts and reflections.
And do we think that the politicians will begin that discussion today? Have they secured that debate, those who want reparations to happen?
I think, you know, this is something that many of the Commonwealth members have said is now time to talk about it. What that will mean in terms of the final communique and what that language will, you know, how that will be spelt out, that is not clear yet. But, you know, it's a discussion that involves, you know, very many members and very many interests. And I think this would just, you know, is likely to be the start of the conversation and one that will clearly continue and intensify in the years to come.
Katie Watson at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa. Thank you.
6:15 is the time. Mental health support for children and young people is a mess, according to the health regulator. Let's talk to Alison Holt, our health correspondent. This is the CQC, Alison, isn't it? And is it their annual report? What is it that they're saying more widely?
Yeah, it is their annual report. So it's a really wide-ranging look at the state of the health and care system in England. And it does point to many pressure points, including problems with the quality of maternity services, difficulties getting GP and dental appointments. It also says the number of new requests for council care services is rising, but more people are being turned down when they ask for that help. But it is particularly concerned about children and young people's mental health services. It says in 2023, an estimated 1 in 5 8 to 25-year-olds had some form of mental illness. It points to problems recruiting psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, occupational therapists, so delays with appointments and referrals for people. It also found that 18 to 21-year-olds had the highest rate of going to emergency departments with mental health issues. So its conclusion is that mental health difficulties in adults often start in childhood. So a lack of this really important early support then creates problems for people for the future.
And when it talks of an inability to recruit, is that about money or conditions or what?
I think it's a combination. I mean, we've seen this across the health and care sector, that there are many areas where there are real difficulties finding people for jobs. But particularly in areas like nursing, for instance. So it's hard to find the mental health nurses that are needed for mental health services, both for children and adults. That's also the same in the care sector. It's really difficult to recruit enough nurses. Part of that will be down to pay. Part of it will be down to conditions, demands and levels of support within those services. So it's a deep-rooted problem. Now, the government says that this report reflects the type of problems that it's already outlined, the challenges it faces, and that it will be tackling those in the next 10 years.
Alison Holt, thank you.
It is now 17 minutes past six. So the Chancellor's changing her borrowing rules in order to allow more money to be spent on infrastructure spending. What does it mean? Well, Felicity Hannah's here with more on that and today's business news too. Morning, Felicity.
Morning. Yes, Rachel Reeves says there will be a technical change to the way debt is measured to allow the government to fund extra investment. The wider debt measure is said to allow for up to £50 billion more in borrowing for investment, although it's not expected that all of that would be allocated at the budget. Now, just a couple of weeks ago, Greg McClymont, Executive Director of Australia's IFM Investors, which has UK investments, including Manchester Airport Group and Anglian Water, was on this very programme calling for changes to these fiscal rules. And he joins me now. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
You were also, I should say, a Labour shadow pensions minister a decade ago. So I'm sure you've got lots of opinions on this. Have you got what you wanted?
Yeah, I think we'll wait, of course, to see the full detail in the budget. But this sounds, from the perspective of a long-term investor in the UK economy, which I am, IFM Investors is, of course, and from the perspective of a major global investor, which IFM Investors also is, this looks like good news. The big challenge in the UK from an infrastructure investor point of view, which of course is what we are, has been that capital investment in the UK has not just been stop-go, it's also been for decades much lower than the UK's peers. So we think this is looks like a very positive development to change the incentives for governments of all stripes, where previously there's been a tendency to cut capital investment in favour of shorter term measures, but also from that longer term perspective of hopefully raising the UK's long-term capital investment numbers, which of course is critical to economic growth.
Now, there will, of course, though, be concerns that loosening the borrowing rules could cause borrowing costs to potentially shoot up. And we've seen that. We've seen bond yields, the cost of government borrowing rising yesterday, perhaps in response to this. And there's some concerns that could cause big problems for the pension industry.
Yes, I think, understandably, there's been lots of focus on what happened a couple of years ago under the Truss administration. I think the situation is pretty different now. 2 years ago, major challenge was, firstly, that government appeared not to be prepared to make its changes go through the independent institutions, the OBR being the obvious one. And I think that made the markets nervous. But also we were 2 years ago in a high inflationary environment, which has particular implications for debt markets. Our view would be that when you look to the long term, and we're owned by pension funds, Felicity, so we're thinking and investing over decades, that if the UK is to grow its economy over decades, it really needs to start to take a pro-investment, pro-co-investment approach to invest alongside pension funds and other major institutions in the energy transition and in other infrastructure. So we are pretty hopeful that this kind of long-term focused change can make a difference.
Do you think that this is important to the country's net zero goals?
Yes, because when you look at the challenge of net zero in terms of the investment necessary, it's going to take a number of different approaches. It's going to take private capital, but also public capital alongside that private capital. And really, the scale of investment necessary demands, I think, a new approach from UK government. As we said a couple of weeks ago that you kindly mentioned, Felicity, on the show, as things stand, anything the government invests in just is marked up as a liability on its balance sheet. That can't be right when you're trying to encourage co-investments over the long term to deliver net zero between government and investors.
But the former Chancellor Jeremy Hunt would probably have liked to have 20 to 50 billion quid extra to spend in his last budget, but he didn't. And he's been very critical of this move. He says it'll punish families. He's concerned it'll push up in, or keep interest rates higher for mortgage payers. Does he have legitimate concerns?
I think a really important point here, certainly from our perspective as a long-term investor, is that this is about the incentive for governments and how they act over the longer term, rather than the fiscal headroom per se, which is created in the short term. Because the incentive has been for governments to cut capital investment whenever things got choppy, which has all kinds of long-term unintended consequences. The obvious one being, of course, that growth is affected. So we see this about changing the incentives to which government operates over the long term. But also, I think, to go back to my point about inflationary environment, things are very different than they looked a couple of years ago in the UK economy in terms of inflation. And that inflation environment is critical to how debt markets think about the UK economy.
Greg McClymont from Australia's IFM Investors, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, we reported yesterday on Tesla's stronger than expected third quarter earnings, and we've seen their shares soar with investors reassured that Tesla's cheaper electric vehicle is on track for production next year. In fact, tens of billions of dollars have been added to the company's market valuation. Let's talk to Swetha Ramachandran, fund manager of global equities at Artemis Investment Management. Swetha, morning.
Morning, Cliff.
This was a bit of a surprise, wasn't it, for investors, with the company's underlying performance looking better than it has for quite a while?
Yes, absolutely. I think following a series of disappointment, the company finally returned to top-line growth. Revenues grew by a modest 2%, but that is better than the declines that they'd seen in the prior two quarters. Gross margins actually expanded for the first time in 2 years. But actually in the mix, if you look at Tesla stock over the last 1 month, even with yesterday's move, which was the best ever in 11 years, they're up 1%. And that's really because there was a lot of disappointment around the robo-taxi event, which was quite underwhelming earlier this 6 months. So some of this is just a reversal of the losses that we had seen in the last 1 month.
Underwhelming, but some of the photos of that thing were pretty standout. Let's stay with EVs, because Bloomberg reports that China is pressuring its automakers to pause expansion in the EU because of escalating trade conflicts. It says that Beijing is telling manufacturers they should hold off on signing new deals and essentially just keep their heads down while negotiations over EU tariffs on Chinese EVs are ongoing. What's going on here? Because some people would think this is as much about the US election as it is about tariffs being imposed by the EU.
Yes, it's really interesting because on the one hand, the Chinese automakers have made no secret of the fact that their growth ambitions are very much internationally focused, and they're gearing up for that to sell cars around the world. But at the same time, within with respect to the EU in particular, they are engaged in a sort of political tit-for-tat in terms of the EU wanting to impose quite heavy tariffs on Chinese EVs on the view that they have been offered unfair subsidies by Beijing. And similarly, China retaliating by imposing its own tariffs on a variety of EU imports, which are relatively modest at this stage on categories like dairy, pork and brandy, with the room to potentially do more. So this is sort of pointing to the fact that Europe, EU can't receive Chinese investment if at the same time they're going to hit Chinese car makers with tariffs, and hence the delay in sort of expansion of capacity in Italy, which was seen as a big a potential area of investment by Chinese EVs to build out capacity in Europe.
Swetha Ramachandran from Artemis Investment Management, thank you very much. Now, UK manufacturers have the pre-budget jitters. That's according to the CBI Industrial Trends Survey. It says sentiment has fallen at its fastest pace in 2 years in UK factories. That has led to downturns in orders and output. And a separate S&P survey says manufacturing product is at a six-month low. Let's talk to somebody who's very much at the coalface of this. Andy Coward, Managing Director at Hillbrush, which is a family-run brush maker and one of the largest in the UK. Andy, morning.
Good morning, Christy.
You've been producing brushes in the UK for over a century. So does this chime what we're hearing there? Does that chime with what you're seeing?
It does, yeah. I mean, we've noticed over the last year, to be honest, customer demand has been slightly depressed compared to last year. And a lot of the feedback we're getting from our sales team out on the road is that that is due to uncertainty in the economy. We were sort of hoping that would have sort of resolved itself after the general election. But with the new Labour government, I think focusing their first 100 days on warning the country's finances in a £22 billion black hole has just created more uncertainty. So we're hoping for a bit more clarity in the budget next week.
We've had some clarity, haven't we? We've had the government confirm it's keeping full expensing a multi-billion pound tax break for investment in plants and machinery. That must be pretty helpful.
But that's definitely something that we've taken advantage of in the past. Over the past 2 years, we've invested over £1 million ourselves in new machinery and also built a new warehouse. So that definitely is something that we hope continues, because it's something that we would continue to invest to improve our productivity. So that would be welcome if that continues.
And we had the government's investment summit at the start of last week. Huge investors, international investors, announcing billions in financing. What does that sort of does that filter down to you? Does that encourage you?
I mean, in terms of the overall economy, hoping to grow the economy, that would be beneficial in terms of confidence for our customers, in terms of, you know, wanting to place orders again. But in terms of us as a business directly, those type of companies, you know, we don't have much to do with them, to be honest. But I think if any potential investment in the UK that helps grow the economy would improve things for us.
How are you viewing intended plans to change workers' rights? So, for example, protection from unfair dismissal and sick pay and maternity and paternity pay from day one, and an end to what's been called exploitative zero-hours contracts.
I mean, I think most of those changes they're proposing are probably the right things to do. I mean, most good employers would support those as well. But I think we've yet to see how they'll be implemented in practice. You know, some of the proposed increases to power for trade unions, you know, flexible working practices. As a manufacturer, that's something that would concern us. It's not easy to go down to 4-day weeks as much as people might want to, and things like that. So we're very much open to it, and we are a good employer when and we already pay above statutory sick pay and things like that for our workforce. So, you know, that thing would only be good, I think, but we just have to see how that comes through in practice.
In a sentence, what are you hoping for in the budget?
I'm hoping to see some investment in that with some real clarity on how they're planning to grow the economy. I think what we've talked about previously just now with your other guests was, you know, the longer term investments. That's all very good. But what are we going to see in the next sort of 6 to 12 months that will help turn the economy around, Andy, and start, you know, creating demand again?
Andy Coward, Managing Director at Hillbrush, thank you very much.
Thank you, Felice. 29 minutes past six. All eyes on the test. Mike Williams can bring us up to date.
Yes, morning, Nick. Let's head live to Rawalpindi, shall we? Day two of that third and deciding test between Pakistan and England. England making 267 in their first innings yesterday, with the home side, Stephen Chemult, resuming half an hour or so ago on 73 for three. How are they getting on?
So Pakistan are 92 for three. They've added 19 runs this morning. No wickets for England so far, but there has been a chance. Shoaib Bashir bowling, edge off Saud Shakil. It hit the pad of the wicketkeeper Jamie Smith and went down. I'm not sure Smith got a glove on it. Would have been a very good catch, but certainly not impossible. So Saud remains on 29, Shaun Masood 22, Pakistan 92 for 3, 175 behind.
All finely poised at the moment. You can follow the ongoing action right now over on Test Match Special on BBC Sounds. Next to football and a busy night of European action, Manchester United are still without a win after three games in this season's Europa League after drawing one apiece away to Fenerbahce. The Turkish side also saw their manager, one Jose Mourinho, red carded and sent to the stands in the second half.
I want to speak about the game. We played absolutely fantastic against a team, in theory, from a superior level. We played fantastic.
Elsewhere, Tottenham have three straight wins after a 1-0 home win over AZ Alkmaar, whilst Rangers produced their biggest European victory for 17 years with a 4-0 win over FCSB of Romania. Meanwhile, in the UEFA Conference League, Chelsea won 4-1 away to Panathinaikos. Hearts defeated Ammonia Nicosia of Cyprus 2-0. Northern Ireland's Larne were 4-1 losers to Shamrock Rovers at Windsor Park, though. But congratulations to the Welsh side, TNS, who are celebrating a first ever victory in the group stages of a major European competition. They beat Astana of Kazakhstan 2-0. Next to cycling, and we've heard publicly from Sir Chris Hoy for the first time since he revealed at the weekend that his cancer diagnosis is terminal.
I'm so grateful to everyone for their incredible kindness and support. Now, it's not the news anyone imagines hearing, and it obviously came as a huge shock. We've taken time to process it as a family, and I now have a deep resolve to turn this incredibly difficult diagnosis into something more positive that can help not just me, but anyone, anywhere living with stage four.
That is a message released on social media from Sir Chris Hoy after the 48-year-old six-time Olympic champion revealed at the weekend that doctors have told him he has between 2 and 4 years to live. And finally, tennis. Britain's Jack Draper has moved into the last eight of the ATP Vienna Open. He'll move up to 17 in the world rankings after that, whilst fellow British number one Katie Bolter reached her fourth WTA quarterfinal of the year at the Pan Pacific Open in Tokyo. And just to mark your card, in the next hour and at 8:25 as well. In fact, this morning we have an exclusive interview with the last remaining member of England's 1966 World Cup winning side, Sir Geoff Hurst, speaking to me later.
Mike, thank you. On Tuesday night, Radio 4 will investigate new cases of the supernatural.
Uncanny, with me, Danny Robbins, on BBC Radio 4.
As I glanced up, I saw a woman in a red robe walking up the stairs.
More real-life accounts of the paranormal.
And all of a sudden, we heard an almighty scream.
To kick off a trilogy of terror, I'm joined by the parapsychologist Evelyn Hollow.
It's supposed to be that if you see this wild hunt, something bad is going to happen.
And the writer and comedian Stuart Lee.
I'm very glad that I had that experience, but I don't believe it happened.
Uncanny on BBC Sounds and Radio 4, beginning next Tuesday night at 11.
Time now is 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London, Nick Robinson in Ipswich, and Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
An investigation by BBC News has found evidence that inflatable boats and other equipment used to ferry migrants across the channel is being hidden in warehouses in western Germany. Two smugglers in the city of Essen provided details of their operation to an undercover reporter and offered a dinghy, engine and 60 life jackets in exchange for €15,000. King Charles has urged a summit of Commonwealth leaders to commit to learning the lessons of the past, but did not directly address the issue of reparations for slavery. The King said it was time to find creative ways to right inequalities that endure within the Commonwealth of 56 nations. Some leaders have said they want the gathering in Samoa to debate the issue of reparations. Efforts are being made to restart negotiations on a ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. US and Israeli officials are set to head to Qatar for talks this weekend. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said he believed the killing of the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar could open the way for an agreement. In northern Gaza, dozens of people are said to have been killed or wounded in the latest Israeli airstrikes. A judge in California will rule on whether to release the brothers Eric and Lyle Menendez, who've served more than three decades in jail for murdering their parents. The brothers had said they shot them in 1989 out of fear they were about to be killed themselves to keep their father's sexual abuse a secret. Prosecutors have now asked the courts to re-sentence the pair, raising the possibility they could be freed on parole. The NHS regulator says many children and young people in England are struggling to get the mental health support they need. The Care Quality Commission cites rising demand and staff shortages. The Health Ombudsman, which handles complaints about the NHS, says the CQC's findings are sobering but not surprising.
Thank you, Tom. 25 minutes to seven now. More on that BBC investigation now, which has exposed the way in which people smugglers use Germany to store the small boats used by migrants to cross the Channel. Let's talk to our Berlin correspondent, Jess Parker. Morning to you, Jess. What have you found?
Good morning. So, yeah, our undercover journalist spent months in on-off contact with a smuggler. He said he'd had bad experiences with the gangs in Calais and wanted to organise his own crossing with friends and family. And he finally met this smuggler in September, and they were joined by another associate as well. And these two men told us, or told our undercover journalist, that they have around 10 warehouses in the city of Essen, that's in West Germany, that all the stuff comes via Turkey, that they can move boats, engines, equipment to northern France from Essen in a few hours. And they offered our undercover journalist the delivery of all the equipment to northern France, so a dinghy, an engine, life jackets, for €15,000. And they also talked about how they'd found a new crossing point, as they put it, although they wouldn't reveal where that was. And the reason we looked into this, Nick, is because it has become clearer that Germany is this key staging post for the trade in small boats later used in the Channel. And one of the main reasons they're being kept there is it's near enough to drive the equipment there quickly, but not under the eye of the French authorities, who are more closely monitoring, of course, the beaches in northern France.
There's another reason too, isn't there, Jess? It isn't illegal to carry large numbers of boats into Germany. There's no reason that you would be in breach of the law, would you? And they've got other big migration problems of their own to worry about.
So I think from the conversation that we had with these two smugglers, the geography seemed to be a greater reason than the legal framework. I mean, they even said that what they were doing wasn't legal. But you're right, technically, it's not a criminal offence to aid the smuggling of people out of the EU under domestic German law. And it's an arguable loophole that has been a source of frustration in the British government. However, the German Interior Ministry say no direct smuggling actually takes place because of the UK and Germany's geography, and they can act in terms of requests from other countries like UK, European arrest warrants. And there's also collateral crime. So if a gang's caught for money laundering or weapons possession, they can be prosecuted in Germany.
Jess Parker, our Berlin correspondent, thank you. We'll be talking about that more throughout the programme.
22 minutes to 7 is the time. The coming ban on smoking in pub gardens is no longer coming, it seems. Harry Farley's our political correspondent. What can you tell us, Harry?
It certainly seems like there is a certain amount of debate and disagreement in Whitehall over exactly what the smoking ban will contain. It was back in August that Keir Starmer confirmed the government was looking at tougher rules on outdoor smoking, including possibly banning it in places like pub gardens, outdoor restaurants and so on. It's thought Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer for England, was particularly supportive of the plan, but it was heavily criticised by hospitality groups about the impact it would have on places like pubs. This morning, The Guardian reports that Downing Street is now blocking the ban on outdoor smoking, citing one official who called it an unserious policy. I put that to Downing Street this morning and gave them the opportunity to deny that. They did not deny that that was the case. And we've spoken to other government sources who tell us that no decision has been taken and the new law on smoking is still being developed. We know the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, wants Labour's smoking ban to go further, wants it to be more ambitious than the version introduced by the previous Conservative government. But he's also talked about having a national debate on the issue and has always framed it as something the government was considering rather than something it would definitely do. The department this morning say they don't comment on leaks, but they do go on to point out that smoking claims 80,000 lives a year and they want to protect children and non-smokers from the harms of secondhand smoking.
Okay. Second question, and it's a really interesting one, isn't it? Keir Starmer has given a bit more detail about who he defines as a working person. He's given this interview to Sky News in which he has said, if you derive your income from assets, so shares, property, etc., and this is a quote, well, they wouldn't come within my definition, which does, well, it sort of confirms something we already suspected, didn't we? Potentially with implications for the budget.
Exactly. There's this ongoing dance about what Labour means when they promise not to put up taxes on working people. Who do they mean by working people? And as you say, that answer by Keir Starmer, fueling speculation, I suppose, about possible increases in, for example, capital gains tax in the budget. We're confident, Justin, that taxes will go up in some form in the budget next week. We're not confident about 100% who will bear the brunt of that, but that, as you say, those comments by Sir Keir Starmer will add to speculation about exactly which taxes might be going up next week.
Harry Farley, thank you.
It is 6:40. Let's take a quick look at what's making the front pages, starting with here in East Anglia. It's interesting, Justin, that the papers, both the Ipswich Star in this town where I'm broadcasting from and the East Anglia Daily Times, have housing stories. I'll be reporting on housing later in the programme ahead of next week's budget. Rents rise to £900 a month in Ipswich, says the Ipswich Star. When does it stop, says the East Anglian, which is reporting on a village's fear over new homes. It's easy to promise new homes, it's quite hard to deliver them, as well. We'll be discussing later. On the front page of the Nationals, a lot of focus on the Chancellor's rewriting of the so-called fiscal or borrowing rules. The FT says it will allow an extra £20 billion of investment in the public sector. The Telegraph highlights a Tory warning saying Reeves warned over £50 billion debt fiddle. And the Mail says Labour's budget ploy will punish mortgage holders. Again, quoting the Conservatives, quoting Jeremy Hunt, the Shadow Chancellor.
And also on the budget, David Blunkett, the former Labour senior cabinet minister and, I suppose, party grandee, now has written a letter to the Times in which he says the widespread reporting of a possible extension of employers' national insurance in next week's budget is very worrying. It is one thing to increase the rate of national insurance, quite another, he says, to levy this on employer pension contributions. As a former working pensions secretary who signed off pensions auto-enrolment, which recognised a genuine crisis for generations to come, I would advise, he says, strongly against this. And he will come on our programme at 8:30 to tell us more.
It's now 6:18. Yesterday we heard from parents and teachers about the problems with the system that's supposed to support children in England who have special educational needs. The public spending watchdog says that things are getting worse. In the Commons yesterday, an education minister promised to fix the system, but couldn't say when parents and young people would see changes. With his report on yesterday in Parliament, here's Sean Curran.
The system is broken. That was the stark verdict from the National Audit Office. It found that the cost of providing help to children and young people with special educational needs and disabilities, or SEND, had risen to more than £10 billion a year. In spite of that, the system often fell short and families were losing confidence. The Schools Minister, Catherine McKinnell, accepted that not every child was being given the chance to achieve and thrive.
Today's report by the National Audit Office is sadly bang on the money. This is a system that has totally lost the confidence of families. Families and children with SEND are being failed on every measure.
She said ministers in the previous Conservative government should hang their heads in shame over the failure to support children with special educational needs.
Our promise to families is that we are absolutely committed to regain parents' confidence in the special educational needs and disability system. But it is a huge and complex reform, and there is no magic wand. There is no quick fix.
The minister had been forced to appear in the Commons after the Speaker agreed that Muneera Wilson, who's the Lib Dem education spokesperson, could ask an urgent question about the NAO report. She said the watchdog had confirmed that the system was in crisis.
The previous Conservative government's abject failure to tackle the systemic problems facing SEND provision have been laid bare for all to see. With half of children waiting more than the statutory 20 weeks for an education, health and care plan, outcomes not improving, special schools over capacity, and damningly the Department for Education not knowing how much capacity is needed to meet future need, we are failing our most vulnerable children.
More and more families worried that their children won't get the help they need have applied for legally binding Education, Health and Care Plans, or EHCPs. The Conservative Shadow Education Minister, James Wilde, said his party had increased SEND funding, and he criticised Labour's decision to add VAT to private school fees. The change will apply to specialist independent schools, but parents of a child with one of the plans won't have to pay the VAT.
Over 100,000 pupils with special educational needs are educated in independent schools without EHCPs. How does the minister think hitting those pupils with a 20% education tax and seeing more pupils move into the state sector as a result will help pressures on schools? And what assessment has she made of the increase in EHC applications that this will also generate, putting further burdens on local authorities?
Catherine McKinnell said ending tax breaks on private schools would help pay for 6,500 new teachers.
Treasury is consulting on plans to enable the changes to come into force in January and how to design those plans to make sure that no child with special educational needs on an education, health and care plan will be adversely affected.
She was challenged by another Conservative, Nick Timothy.
Parents in my constituency are not interested in what the Minister thinks about the Conservative Party, and they may recall that EHCPs were introduced under the Coalition government. They want us to work together to make things better, and we all know that there's a problem with EHCPs, which have led to a tripling of costs for county councils.
The minister said she was always willing to work with politicians from other parties, but she didn't accept that a government that had only been in office for 5 months was to blame for the problems. Labour's Julie Minns said she was speaking both as a parent whose child was badly failed and as an MP dealing with struggling parents.
So I would ask respectfully that members of the opposition, that until and unless you have walked in my shoes and the shoes of your constituents, and this includes the Shadow Secretary of State, that you show a little humility and decorum in how you respond on this issue.
The schools minister agreed and said the government wanted mainstream schools to be inclusive so they could meet the needs of the vast majority of children with special educational needs and disabilities.
That was Yesterday in Parliament with Sean Curran. You can hear more on events Yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock. Radio 4 Extra and digital radio as well.
13 minutes to 7. Now, how should the water industry be reorganised in this country? That is the focus of the commission established by the government this week. Now, we're familiar with the idea that there is a problem of sewage discharges in our seas and rivers. But this morning we're highlighting another problem. Water companies telling businesses that they cannot expand if that means using more water. They are rationing water. Essex and Suffolk Water has imposed a moratorium on new mains water connections due to last for 9 years. And we can talk to one of their customers now. Alan Rydalge joins us. He's a co-founder with his son of something called the Humber Doocy Brewing Company, based just up the road from where I'm broadcasting this morning in Ipswich. It's based in Bacton near Stowmarket. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What have you been told by the water company?
Well, we were told completely and utterly out of the blue in early July that we would, as you've already explained, not be able to use any more water going forward until it was reviewed in 2033.
For a brewing company, that's serious.
Well, it's worse because we're really a startup, so we haven't reached our potential yet, our maximum usage of water.
Water with bits added, isn't it?
Essentially, yes. And we also use water for cleaning.
And so, effectively, does that put a cap on any hope of you really getting this startup to be a big and successful business?
It does, absolutely.
So what are your options now?
Well, our options are the one that we won't accept, which is to stop and give up. One of our options is to move to an area which doesn't have those restrictions, and we are literally 100 metres away from an area without that restriction. And the other one is to try and negotiate or get the water company to actually understand that businesses are in different stages.
What are they saying to you, Mr. Rydalge?
Well, at the moment, it's completely, this is the moratorium. They haven't changed their position whatsoever. We are talking with them, and we've been supported by the Federation of Small Businesses, Mid-Suffolk District Council, Suffolk Chamber of Commerce, and I'm hopeful that through discussion, we can move this forward.
They say, the water company, Essex and Suffolk Water, they've got a problem. They say to us, we sympathise with affected businesses, but we've got to protect water supply to our existing customers, especially to households who we have an absolute legal requirement to supply. And they're under environmental pressure not to abstract, as it's called, more groundwater, not to take more than the environment can sustain.
Yeah, that's their statement, and they don't seem to alter from their statement or try and defend it. I think probably my feeling is that they've overreacted to an Environment Agency diktat, possibly at their parent company level, because they're aware of all the furore around water companies in general. And
in a sentence, therefore, Mr. Rydalge, how do you feel about the state of water in this country?
It really needs a thorough review.
Alan Rydalge, thank you very much indeed. Good luck with your startup business, the Humber Ducey Brewing Company. Thanks for joining us.
It is 7:09. 1 in 5 8 to 25-year-olds has a mental illness, according to the CQC, the Care Quality Commission, in its annual report. And it says, crucially, that there are not enough professionals to deal with all of this. We will talk in a moment to the mother of two children who've been through the system and not found it remotely satisfactory. But first to James Bullion, who is the interim chief inspector of the CQC and is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tell us more about what you found about. Is it just an absence of people, or is it more than that?
Well, getting the right care and at the right time is an issue for everyone. But in relation to the children that we found, with that number that you've mentioned, you know, up to 20% between 8 and 25, the issue is a combination of not having the right staff. So real gaps in the numbers of healthcare staff working in mental health, leading to pressure and not responding quickly enough to those children. So it is a matter of resources and staff for the healthcare system, but how we're organised in our local systems, in our integrated care system, isn't prioritising mental health to the extent that it needs to, so that we can respond to these children.
If the government is hearing you and thinking, OK, what do we do? What would you say? Where do they start? What needs to happen?
Well, first of all, the statistic is that there's been a 30% increase. In June 2024, there was a 30% increase compared with June 2022 of children with an open mental health service referral. The numbers of services responding to that had only increased by 11% during that period. So there's a doubling of resources that we need to respond. That's the first place to start. The second issue, though, is to make people working in healthcare and their jobs improved so that they can respond appropriately to mental health care needs for children. And, of course, this is really consequential on those young people. It's not just a question of the stats. In our report, we're profiling where you don't get good help, health and good service responses, you end up with children not getting their exams, deteriorating, sometimes facing hospitalisation. Where people do get help, you can see there's a marked difference in their achievements, and that means they're less likely to go on and become adults with mental health problems. So it's really potentially failing the future unless we respond.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bullion, because let's talk about that now with Rachel Bannister, who's the mother of two children who've been through this system and are still struggling with the repercussions of it. Ms. Bannister, good morning to you.
Hi, thanks so much for inviting me on. It's incredibly important to listen to the lived experience stories and perspectives.
Yeah, well, look, thank you for coming on. Tell us about your story. So you had two daughters, is it, who've been through the system?
I've actually got three daughters, but two daughters have been through the system. And I should just say at the start that our story isn't an easy one to listen to hear. And it's still quite difficult to tell, but, you know, I do believe it's important. So we're talking about the last decade, really, when my eldest daughter was showing difficulties with her mental health, and we had a good GP that made the referral quite quickly, and we were pretty much in the context of the time, and probably even today, seen pretty quickly, but being seen and actually starting holistic treatment, you know, that's the difference. And we didn't get that package of care. I had this naive on reflection expectation, really, that we'd enter mental health services, child and adolescent mental health services, and that we'd have the similar continuity of care we'd had through primary care, and that there would be this mental health toolbox with everything that we needed to help her recover. And actually, the reality was hundreds of children. She was one of hundreds of children, because I got the Freedom of Information figures back then. And we had, but there wasn't the resources and the staffing back then that we needed.
And at one stage, one of your daughters was sent to a hospital 300 miles away.
Yeah, 300 miles away. So basically, we had 2 years under the CAMHS system where nothing really happened. We had a lovely family therapist and psychiatrist, but those appointments were very erratic, and there wasn't a package of care, you know, that was able to keep her at home, keep her safe, and she had an eating disorder, and to help her gain weight. So initially, she was sent 50 miles away from home, and then 100 miles, and then 300 miles.
Gosh, so I can imagine the strain of that on her and on you.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that we don't acknowledge, or perhaps understand enough, the impact on the whole family. So when you fail a young person, you fail their family, their social networks, you know, and essentially you fail society. There's a cost to everybody when it goes wrong. And she just became one of tens of thousands that are a victim of the revolving door of inpatient, outpatient care. I mean, that the trauma of what happened to her has impacted her, and it's still impacting her. And the iatrogenic harm of what she had to witness in hospital.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real horror story. It also made me ill. I ended up needing acute care. My middle daughter was out of school because her anxiety was so acute. And
it's
ended
a really
up
interesting point, that actually, isn't it, about the impact on wider families? I mean, do you think, is it simply or fundamentally a lack of staffing, do you think?
I think staffing, absolutely. I mean, the headlines of the CQC report is rising demand and staff shortages. We had staff shortages back then. So, you know, in my view, we need to look at places where it's working. And it's working in places like the Royal Free London, where they have an intensive eating disorder service in the community. Been running for 12 years. No deaths, no serious incidents there. I mean, since we've been through this, I feel lucky that we survived. And what a terrible indictment of mental health services, that survival is a matter of luck. So I set up a charity, you know, based on our experiences. And what I've discovered in that time, that there are really good ways of working. I met Keir Starmer recently, and he wrote a pledge for our charity.
All right.
And the headline is one of the urgent.
We're out of time, but that's good to know that you have met him, and it's something we will return to unquestionably. Rachel Bannister, thank you for talking to us this morning, and James Bullion as well.
You're saying that people who...
Now, coming up very soon on Radio 4, indeed tomorrow night, a unique perspective on the American election.
The Paul Jonathan Pye US election specials from BBC Radio 4. Join me, Jonathan Pye, as I swap coverage of dull, boring Westminster for much more fun and exciting Washington, taking a look at all the drama of the US election. Assassination attempts, dog eating, a candidate with an annoying laugh, and a complete lack of coherent policies all round, with the future of Western democracy at stake. Should be quite a laugh.
The two-part Call Jonathan Pye US election special starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow night at 11.
To Simon King now and the weather.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. We've got a bit of rain this morning in southwest England and Wales. That rain is going to move to the northeast, clearing away. There'll be some sunny spells developing, but then also some blusterous showers coming into the southwest. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 14 to 16 degrees. In southeast England, the Midlands and eastern England, some mist and fog early on. That's going to clear away. Pretty cloudy. We could see some patchy rain coming into the Midlands, maybe parts of the southeast later, but also again, much later this afternoon, into the evening, there'll be some clearer skies developing, so some late sunshine. Temperatures 16 to 20 Celsius, way above the average for the time of year. Across northern England, pretty cloudy with some very light and patchy rain across Merseyside, the Lake District, staying pretty overcast, but perhaps some brighter skies developing in the far northwest of England. Highs of 14 to 17. And for Northern Ireland, it's a wet start to your day. Rain will ease off, becoming dry but overcast all day. Highs of 14, 15 Celsius. And for Scotland, mostly cloudy, some light rain in the northwest. We could see a bit of light rain elsewhere across Scotland today, but it is one of a largely dry day with lots of cloud and highs of 11 to 14.
Thank you, Simon. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Justin Webb. It's 7 o'clock on Friday the 25th of October. The headlines this morning: an undercover BBC investigation has seen how criminals are using warehouses in Germany to store the small boats that take migrants across the Channel. The King has said the Commonwealth has to learn the lessons of its past and tackle what he called enduring inequalities. And prosecutors have paved the way for the possible release of Eric and Lyle Menendez, the brothers at the centre of one of America's most notorious murder cases. And coming up in the next hour of the programme, a day after the Chancellor signalled that she's ready to borrow more to get Britain building in next week's budget, Nick is in Suffolk, where he's been looking at the challenges to the planning system and the opposition they may still face.
We're certainly not blockers. We are not calling for the stoppage in housing or a halt on housing. We are calling for the right houses in the right locations. There are lots of examples where the locations are absolutely inappropriate.
And Kate Bush has told this programme exclusively that she is preparing to go back into the studio to record a new album.
I like to think that all my albums are different they from are. Each other. And, yeah, I'm sure it will be different. I mean, we've all been through a lot.
We'll hear more from her interview with Emma before 7:30. The BBC News is read this morning by Tom Sanders.
An investigation by BBC News has found evidence that small inflatable boats used to ferry migrants across the Channel are being hidden in warehouses in western Germany. An undercover reporter was told by criminals that the equipment was being stored in multiple sites in the city of Essen. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
This year has already become the deadliest for migrant crossings on the English Channel, according to a United Nations agency. The supply line for these boats stretches far back into Europe. Our undercover journalist, who posed as a Syrian man hoping to get to Britain, met and exchanged messages with two smugglers in the West German city of Essen. They offered him a deal, €15,000 for a dinghy, engine and 60 life jackets to be delivered to the Calais area. They told him they had about 10 warehouses around Essen storing equipment that had come via Turkey. Britain's National Crime Agency says Germany's become a central location for the storage of small boats. Cities like Essen are close but not too close to northern France's more heavily monitored beaches. The German and UK governments say cooperation to crack down on the gangs behind this trade is good or accelerating.
The King has urged Commonwealth countries to commit to learning the lessons of the past at the opening of a meeting of the organisation's leaders in Samoa. Some members of the 56-nation group, made up mainly of former British colonies, want a discussion about reparations for slavery. The government has rejected suggestions that the UK should pay. King Charles, who's head of the Commonwealth, didn't make a direct reference to the matter in his speech, but said it was time to find creative ways to right inequalities that endure.
Our cohesion requires that we acknowledge where we have come from. I understand from listening to people across the Commonwealth how the most painful aspects of our past continue to resonate. It is vital, therefore, that we understand our history to guide us to make the right choices in the future.
Efforts are being made to restart negotiations on a ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. US and Israeli officials are set to head to Qatar for talks this weekend. In northern Gaza, dozens of people are said to have been killed or wounded in the latest Israeli airstrikes. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
Local rescuers say 11 residential buildings were bombed in Jabalia refugee camp, where they believe there are some 150 casualties. It's become increasingly difficult to verify information from the area, which has been besieged by Israeli forces. Israel's military says its offensive in northern Gaza aims to stop Hamas fighters from regrouping. In a separate development, last night the Israeli army said it had killed a Hamas commander who took part in the deadly 7th of October attacks, identifying him as an employee of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA confirmed he was a staff member. As the war rages on, there are renewed efforts to restart ceasefire and hostage release talks. Israel says it's sending the head of its Mossad intelligence agency to Doha on Sunday to meet the CIA director and Qatar's prime minister. Hamas says there's been no change in its conditions for a deal.
Lebanese state media say two cameramen and an engineer have been killed in an Israeli airstrike on a guest house used by the media in the south of the country. Two of the dead worked for the pro-Iranian broadcaster Al-Mayadeen, the other for a Hezbollah station called Al-Manar. Israel has not commented on the attack in the town of Hasbaya. A judge in California will rule on whether to release the brothers Eric and Lyle Menendez, who served more than three decades in jail for the murder of their parents. They alleged that their father, a media executive, had sexually abused them, and their first trial in the mid-1990s garnered media attention across the US. Now, prosecutors have asked the court to re-sentence the pair, raising the possibility they could be freed. Our Los Angeles correspondent Emma Vardy reports.
The murders at the family's Beverly Hills mansion in 1989 gripped the world. During their initial trial, which was televised, Eric and Lyle Menendez said they'd been physically and sexually abused by their father and argued the killings were manslaughter because they were in danger. It ended with a hung jury. Then in a subsequent trial, they were convicted and sentenced to life without parole. But last year, new evidence was revealed which backed up the brothers' claims of abuse. Now the district attorney for LA, George Gascon, has recommended that the brothers be given a lighter sentence, which means they could walk free.
They have been in prison for nearly 35 years. I believe that they have paid their debt to society. And the system provides a vehicle for their case to be reviewed by a parole board.
Eric and Lyle Menendez recently gained widespread attention with two Netflix series made about the case, which some say would have been treated differently by the courts nowadays, given modern understanding of sexual abuse. A judge will now make the final decision as to whether they will be released from jail.
The NHS regulator says many children and young people in England are struggling to get the mental health support they need. The Care Quality Commission cites rising demand and staff shortages. The Health Ombudsman, which handles complaints about the NHS, says the CQC's findings are sobering but not surprising. Here's our Social Affairs editor, Alison Holt.
The Care Quality Commission's annual assessment of the state of the health and care system in England points to many pressure points, including problems with the quality of maternity services. It also says the number of new requests for council care is rising, but more people are being turned down. It is particularly concerned about children and young people's mental health services, saying in 2023 an estimated 1 in 5 8 to 25-year-olds had a mental illness. It points to problems recruiting psychiatrists, psychologists and nurses. It says mental health difficulties in adults often start in childhood, so a lack of early support creates problems for the future. The CQC is an organisation which itself is troubled after three highly critical reports about its operational performance in the last few months. This week it got its third chief executive since June.
A technology business leader has been named as the most influential black person in Britain. Dean Forbes, who's the chief executive of the software firm Fortero, has been selected by judges on behalf of the publication The Power List, which showcases black role models. Mr. Forbes says he's experienced homelessness in the past and has set up a social mobility not-for-profit organisation to help underserved communities. Kate Bush has told this programme she's really ready to do something new, 13 years after her last studio album. In a rare interview to mark the release today of an animation she's helped create for the charity War Child, the singer-songwriter says she has plenty of ideas. Our arts correspondent David Siliso has been listening.
I was born.
Set to Kate Bush's Snowflake, Little Shrew was created to highlight the impact of war on children.
In a cloud.
The song is from her last album, released 13 years ago. But speaking to Emma Barnett, she says she now feels ready to return to the studio.
I'm very keen to start working on a new album when I've got this finished. I've got lots of ideas. I'm really looking forward to getting back into that creative space. It's been a long time.
However, 10 years after her last live performance, when asked about returning to the stage, she said she wasn't there yet.
David Siliso reporting.
Thank you, Tom. We'll hear more of that gasp of excitement about Kate Bush's new album a little bit later in the programme. The full interview is coming up at after 8 o'clock. It is now 7:09. We will stick with the fiscal rules that govern how much government can borrow. They're non-negotiable. That's what Rachel Reeves said before the election. We'll not fiddle the figures, she said, to get different results. But yesterday, the Chancellor confirmed widespread speculation that she would change the way those rules are defined. To put it simply, expanding what it is the government counts as borrowing to allow billions more to be borrowed each year to invest in roads or hospitals. Many economists have called for precisely this change to avoid cutting spending on investments at a time when money is tight. But the Conservatives are warning that the change could lead to higher mortgage rates. And Doug Williams, founder of the Centre for Economics and Business Research, agrees.
The price of money in the markets has gone up. It's gone up by about 0.25%, which means that anyone borrowing money, for example, for a mortgage, is going to have to pay extra. And that is something that happened when Liz Truss was Prime Minister, and there was a lot of concern about her mini-budget. It's happening again, and that's just simply as a result of the change in the rules that the Chancellor has announced. These are complex rules, but the main thing is that the government can, in theory, borrow about £50 billion extra if they meet the rules than they would otherwise have been able to.
That is the theory, that is the criticism. So what is the defence of a change in the way the rules are written that most people predict will actually involve borrowing about £20 billion extra a year? That's about £700 per household. Well, I played that clip to James Murray, who is Treasury Minister, technically called the Exchequer Secretary at the Treasury, to get his reaction.
What I would say is that at the heart of what the Chancellor has set out is restoring economic stability and making sure that fiscal responsibility underpins what we do in office. If you look at the two fiscal rules that the Chancellor has been setting out, that's very clear. The first rule, the stability rule, is about making sure that day-to-day spending is fully paid for through tax receipts. And the second rule, the investment rule, is about getting debt falling whilst making sure we support investment with guardrails to make sure those investments are good value for money and deliver a return for the taxpayer.
Before the election, the Chancellor, she was the Shadow Chancellor then, of course, said she would, quote, not fiddle the figures to get a different result. Well, that's exactly what you are doing, isn't it? You're fiddling with the rule to allow yourself to borrow billions of pounds more.
Well, not at all, because these rules the Chancellor set out are in line with what we said in the manifesto. And actually, the first rule, the stability rule, is the one that bites first. That's the one that says that day-to-day spending has to be paid for through tax receipts. Now, that's a tough rule, but it's one that should give people confidence about our approach to the public finances. The second rule, the investment rule, is one that is actually in line with the approach the IMF has been advocating around the importance of public investment within a robust fiscal framework. And the reason why that public investment is so important, can I just say, the reason why that's so important
can understand.
So the reason why that's so important is to also leverage in that private sector investment. You know, and we saw at the investment summit recently, £63 billion of private sector investment announced, which is critical to getting our economy growing.
Okay, let's translate this into language that people are not operating the markets and not economists and frankly are not politicians too can understand. You are you not, changing the rules in order to allow yourself to borrow potentially £50 billion more. Most people think you'll borrow about £20 billion more. That's £700 a household. Why is it sensible to take that risk with the cost of people's mortgages?
Well, the Chancellor will set out the details of the fiscal rules of the budget next week. But what's very clear...
Sure, but why is it sensible to do that?
What's sensible is to make sure that we make responsible investments in the future of our country, because we need that investment to get the economy growing. And what the Chancellor has been very clear about is that within the investment rule, there will be guardrails. Now, this is where the OBR, the National Audit Office, will look at investments to make sure that they are value for money, that they support growth, and they're the right investments for the future of our country.
Now, forgive me, Mr. Murray, this is an interesting answer, but to a different question. That is an answer to a question about how you make sure you're spending sensibly. I'm asking you to address those who say you're taking a risk in the markets, and it's a risk with the price of borrowing money, which ultimately could cost people in their mortgages.
Well, no, because I think what markets will look at is the package the Chancellor announced next week. And what they will see is a Chancellor who is introducing a new rule, one that's different from the previous government, to get public spending in balance, day-to-day spending paid for through tax receipts, so no borrowing for day-to-day spending. They will see a Chancellor who is committed to getting debt falling, and they'll see a Chancellor who is putting in place guardrails around public investment. Now, all of that will give confidence to markets, will make sure economic stability is back in the heart of Treasury, in the heart of government. And actually, that economic stability is the basis on which we can get the economy growing. And we know, and we said this through the election, and it's true now we're in office, that investment and growth is the way to make people better off and to keep mortgages and prices as low as possible.
Well, let's turn to tax, because the Prime Minister said yesterday the next week's budget would, in his words, clear the decks and clear up the mess, which is code for saying we're going to put taxes up to deal with spending problems. You promised not to put taxes up on working people. Who are working people?
Well, as the Chancellor has said, working people are people who go out to work for their income. And we were very clear in the election in terms of our manifesto promises that we wanted to protect working people. And by
do
that,
landlords
we meant
work?
Well, we're talking about where people get their income from, and our priority in the manifesto, and it's a manifesto commitment that we're keeping, is to make sure that we protect working people in terms of not raising any of the rates of income tax, national insurance, VAT, making sure that those that promise is kept to protect working people in what is otherwise going to be
work?
It's going to be a difficult budget. We're talking about where people get their income from. And
well,
working
I'm
people,
talking about a simple question. Do landlords work? I think I've asked you five times now. Do they work?
Well, we're talking about where people get their income from. And people, if they go out to work and they get their income from work, that is where we want to make sure that we protect
so
them.
What you're saying, just to be clear, I'm not trying to score points. I'm just trying to get clarity. You're saying that people who earn their money from owning a house or owning shares or selling a business, by your definition, they are not working people.
Well, look, I'm not going to get into too many hypotheticals here, Nick, but what I'm very clear about is our commitment in the manifesto around working people. And that's why we pointed directly to the rates of income tax, to national insurance, to VAT. And beyond that, the Chancellor will set out the full package of the budget next week.
So let me just ask you one other thing. It looks as if the government wants to go further to ban smoking, but is dropping the idea of banning smoking in pub gardens. Is that something you can tell us more about, something you can confirm?
Look, I'm not going to comment on leaks, Nick. We've been clear what we said in public about our approach to tackling smoking and to vaping. You know, one of the shocking things, as well as the number of people, obviously, who die and get ill from smoking, is also the number of young people who are smoking. You know, a quarter of 11 to 15-year-olds have vaped in the last year. We need to do something about that, and that's why the tobacco and vaping bill is focused on banning those vapes which are targeted directly young people to make sure they don't get addicted to these nicotine products.
Treasury Minister James Murray, thanks for joining us this morning.
And at 18 minutes past seven, let us turn to Chris Mason, who is listening to that all the way from Samoa. Chris, what did you make of what you just heard?
Very interesting hearing Nick's conversation there about the definition of working people. It reminded me of the labels that we've heard in the last decade or so, the squeezed middle, hard-working families, just about managing, alarm clock Britain, these kind of broad, intentionally vague definitions that almost everyone could reasonably suggest might include them, unless you are either kind of very poor or very, very rich. It's a useful exercise at the moment, this question, in the context of next week, because who is the Prime Minister, who is the Chancellor going to look out for, and frankly, who are they going to clobber? Now, it isn't news to say, because we've been reporting it for weeks, haven't we? The expectation is that the increases in tax are going to fall on those who, when you look at the statistics, are better off. And even though they don't necessarily define themselves as such. We've talked about inheritance tax, haven't we? Capital gains tax, amongst others. They look like they are heading north.
Meanwhile, I don't know if you get the Times in Samoa, but David Blunkett's made an interesting intervention. He's written a letter to the Times saying the widespread reporting of a possible extension of employers' national insurance in next week's budget is very worrying. He says he would advise strongly against it because of the impact on auto-enrolment and pensions more generally. I mean, it's, if they've decided to do it, it's too late not to do it, I suppose. But it is an interesting last-minute intervention from a significant figure in the party.
Indeed so, yeah. And another example of where that definition of quote-unquote working people has proved interesting in the last few weeks, because if you run a small business, you might regard yourself as a working person, but also therefore the payer of employer national insurance. So one wonders in that context with an intervention like this, and we head into the realms of a splash of speculation here, what mitigations around some potential increases an employer national insurance might be built in to take account of that kind of critique that we hear from Lord Blunkett.
Chris Mason in Samoa. Thank you. 20 past seven is the time. We're reporting this morning that there is a German link to the small boats crossing the Channel, and an important one too. The boats themselves are being stored, a lot of them, in Western Germany. Our undercover reporter, being voiced by a BBC producer for his own safety, described a meeting with a smuggler in the city of Essen in Western Germany.
They took my phone. Al-Khal started asking questions. Who are you? What are you planning? I want to know all about you. They tell me the equipment comes from Turkey. They have about 10 warehouses around Essen. Police raided one a few days ago, but they separate their stock and give the bait to police.
Let's talk to Tobias Bacheli, who is a member of the German Parliament for the Green Alliance, a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee as well. Good morning to you. Hello, Mr. Bacheli, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Ah, wonderful. Yes, we got you too now. Is it widely known in Germany that this is going on, that there are significant numbers of boats being stored in the western parts of the country?
No, not widely known. The German discussion around crossing with boats is mainly focused on the Mediterranean Sea. And when it comes to smuggling, it's also a discussion that's rather, I would argue, a bit centered on who wants to get to Germany and how. And there's very little discussion around how people want to move forward from Germany or how they're using Germany as a platform, as it is described in the coverage.
Yeah, and it's understandable in a way. Germany does have its own problems to deal with, but it has been talked about off and on, hasn't it, for some time, is whether laws in Germany can be altered so that these vessels can be confiscated, which I think at the moment they can't be, can they? Is there any prospect, do you think, of that happening?
As I said, the main public debate is not really focused on that. Yeah, there has been reportings, and of course there is a bit of a political debate, and France, I think it was also mentioned in the report, is pushing Germany to acknowledge that it's actually happening at their borders, and therefore European border crossings are involved. But the broader German debate is really much, and as I said, it doesn't really fit into the picture. Those who are pushing for a critical debate around migration, that are pushing, those who are pushing for that, it doesn't really fit into this agenda to talk about how people want to move forward from Germany.
But do you think there's a way that the British government could get it to by going to Germany? In fact, Keir Starmer was there recently, wasn't he, just a few days ago, and saying to Chancellor Schultz or to anyone, and possibly at a kind of police-to-police level, we know these boats are here, we know what they're being used for, can you do something?
Yes, definitely. And I would really distinguish between political circles and political discussions and the broader public discussion here. And as I said, the political discussion is there. Of course, there is also German history where border crossings have a different remember them different because there was an inner German border. But of course, there is the discussion around that. And I think we all need to acknowledge that those boats are not safe to cross. And I mean that in a sense, it's highly dangerous that people are forced onto those boats, are risking their lives. And I mean, many of them are actually also losing their lives.
Tobias Backley, member of the German Parliament. Thank you very much for talking to us.
24 minutes past seven. Fliss is back with the business news. And Fliss, the retail giant Frasers Group has written to Boohoo, calling for an emergency meeting. Tell us more.
Absolutely. In fact, if you're thinking of settling in to watch a film or a box set this evening, it might not be as dramatic as this is. Frasers Group, which is Boohoo's largest shareholder with a 27% holding, wants to sack Boohoo's current interim CEO, John Little, and appoint Frasers founder, Mike Ashley, instead. The group owns Sports Direct, Evans Cycles, Debenhams, among others, has said in an open letter that it believes Boohoo's board has lost its ability to manage Boohoo's business and investments. Let's speak to Catherine Shuttleworth, who's a retail expert and chief executive of Savvy Marketing. Catherine, morning.
Good morning, Flister.
What is it that Boohoo has been doing? How has it been performing recently to warrant such a brutal intervention?
Well, Boohoo's had a pretty torrid time of late. It's lost an awful lot of sales, particularly to some of the new players in the fast fashion market, so businesses like Shein, and their performance has been pretty awful. They've announced that they're going to cut 1,000 jobs, they've taken on a new debt facility, and they're going to have a review of their business, and they're not ruling out selling off parts of the business as well and restructuring it. And I think this has given Mike Ashley an opportunity to say, look, this isn't on. I want a bigger seat at the table, a bigger part of these discussions. And he's sent off this fairly incendiary note that we're all talking about this morning.
Incendiary is the word. What might be Mike Ashley's strategy here? What would he do with a bigger seat at the table?
Well, I think he's never really got over losing Debenhams back in 2020. That went to a bid and the Kamani family won it and it went into the Boohoo group and Mike Ashley didn't. I think he's very interested in that and he thinks he can do better with it. And he'll be wanting to have his say and settle a bit of a score here. Plus, I think he genuinely believes he's got a better way of running that business and that the Frasers group have got a better way of talking to those shoppers that are the shoppers that would shop with Boohoo and their various brands.
And what have we seen then with Frasers Group and how it deals with the businesses it owns outright? I mean, could this move, if it happened, change the shape of UK retail?
It could do a little bit. I mean, the Frasers Group are starting now to show their impact. I mean, yesterday in Leeds, they opened their new Frasers department store, a big flannel store that goes into an old Debenhams store. I think they could. I think they have got a good grasp of younger shoppers who do want to go back to the high street. They want to be able to buy online, but they also want a really fantastic high street offer that they can go and enjoy. And I think the Frasers Group, under the leadership of Michael Murray, who's the son-in-law of Mike Ashley, actually does understand younger shoppers pretty well. And I think that's what they're trying to say here is, look, we can do better than you can. And by the way, there are some scores to settle too.
Catherine Shuttleworth, thank you very much.
And thank you, Fliss. 27 minutes past seven. Our fellow presenter, Emma Barnett, has been sitting down for an exclusive and rare interview with Kate Bush, the musician, songwriter, now filmmaker, to watch a new short animated film that she's made. It's called Little Shrew. It tells the tale of an animal caught up in war, trying to survive, and it's out today. And you can hear the full interview, which has the details as well of Kate Bush's plans to return to the world of music after 8 o'clock. For now, a snippet. Here is what Kate told Emma about how Little Shrew came about.
So I started working on it over a couple of years ago, and it was not long after the Ukrainian war broke out. I think it was such a shock for all of us. You know, it's been such a long period of peace that we've all been living through. And I just felt that I really wanted to make a little animation that would feature originally a little girl. It was really the idea of a child and children that are caught up in war. I wanted to draw attention to, you know, how horrific it is for children. And so I came up with this idea for a little storyboard and felt that actually it would be more, people would probably be more empathetic towards a little creature rather than a human. I came up with the idea of it being a little shrew.
I mean, I think that's fascinating, that perhaps sometimes some people's empathy is bigger when they see a defenceless animal in a situation versus even a child.
I mean, I think to a certain extent we've all become really desensitized by the violence that we see in films all the time, you know, where people are just being slaughtered, really.
Yeah.
But if a dog were to be killed in a film, everyone would be up in arms. It's a terrible thing to say, but I think there is an element of truth in that.
What's clear here is you've been working hard on this, and you've got such a strong sense, like you say, you've been having this in your mind, you've been working on it for 2 years, you've got such a strong sense of your vision and where you want to go, and that seems to be a thread throughout your work, that you have this idea and you stay very clear and stay very true to it. Is that a good way of describing it? Is that difficult to do?
Well, I think sometimes when you have ideas, it can take a long time before you can actually get to a point to manifest them. I suppose it's the test of whether you feel the idea is strong enough, isn't it? Otherwise you wouldn't keep hold of it.
I think I would be personally held to some sort of very serious account by those listeners to the radio if I didn't ask if you've got some ideas for music at the moment. Are you working on any new material?
Not at the moment, but I've been caught up doing a lot of archive work over the last few years. On all kinds of different levels, redesigning our website, putting a lyric book together, and I'm very keen to start working on a new album when I've got this finished. I've got lots of ideas. I'm really looking forward to getting back into that creative space. It's been a long time.
Really? Is it something that you've been wanting to do for a while?
Yeah, it is really, yes. I mean, I think particularly the last year, I felt really ready to start doing something new.
What do you think it is now about potentially wanting to make more music, new music again? Is there something that's sort of changed with you or some inspiration, if you don't mind me asking?
This animation has taken up a lot of time this year, so really once this is finished, I'll be ready to start anew.
Well, there we are. Paul McCartney announced there was a new Beatles track going to be played, talking to Martha, and there Emma got the story from Kate Bush about that new thing. Look, stories coming up in the sport as well. Here's Mike with the sports news at 29 minutes to 8.
Yes, thank you, Nick. England on the hunt for more Pakistan wickets on day two of the deciding test in Rawalpindi. Come in, Jonathan Agnew with the latest.
Just the one wicket taken so far. 23 overs bowled by England. Spin predominantly. A few overs have seen from Gus Atkinson, but a lovely delivery from Bashir Dismiss. Shah Massoud, the Pakistan captain, very well caught by Ollie Pope. Close in a ball that spun sharply. There haven't been enough of those, though, from England's point of view. 143 for four is Pakistan's situation. They trail by 124.
And coverage continues right now on Test Match Special over on BBC Sounds. Now, though, let's hear from someone whose name has become a byword in English football for much heralded former glories, Sir Geoff Hurst. The 82-year-old is now the sole surviving member of England's 1966 World Cup winning side. And he has a new book out reflecting on that famous match and his late teammates. But before we focus on that life-defining moment for him nearly 60 years ago, what about his thoughts on today's game? Sir Geoff told me he doesn't envy the lifestyle and eye-watering salaries of the modern-day Premier League footballer, but does agree that players have become less accessible to supporters.
Absolutely. I think they live a different kind of lifestyle and remote from the fans and so on. At West Ham United, after a game, we went to a pub called the Black Lion. Now, can you imagine players playing for Premier League clubs going half a mile to a pub next to the club? And that pub called the Black Lion is still there. And I'm saying this again with a huge smile on my face.
But do you recognise yourself in the modern day footballer? Not physically, of course, but when you say watch West Ham and you look at Jarrod Bowen up top for West Ham, the art of playing football, I guess, it hasn't changed as much. You kick the ball and try and score a goal. But has the game and football itself as an entity transformed so much in six decades that can you even see yourself doing what these lads are doing?
Yes, I can, quite comfortably. I think the game has changed a little bit. I think it, in some respects, it's a little boring. And looking at the game at the top level, looking at the couple of Euros finals, that as a striker, we get the ball wide into wing positions and we don't seem to cross the ball as much. And I think as a striker, I'd be saying, get the damn ball in there. And it goes back to the midfield and the fullback and back to the goalkeeper. So I do feel sorry for Harry Kane to an extent. He's got some criticism, but the ball isn't going into the box as much as you would probably like it as a striker.
Well, what about this current England team? So many promising players, two European Championship finals in succession and a World Cup semi-final in the last 6 years, quarter-final last time out in Qatar. Is this England team closer than any in the last 60 years coming to emulate what your side did in 1960?
Without question. We have some of the best group of young players we've had, and I say young, but they're all very well established in the clubs anyway. And we've been that close. I mean, Gareth Southgate said an awful lot of criticism, which I just don't get. The answer is yes. You have to be positive as a person, as a player. And I'm quite positive that we can do it again, particularly with these players who have three or four top years left at their clubs and for England.
So could it be, Jeff, in 18 months' time, 2026, 60 years since your team famously won the World Cup. Could the next World Cup be coming home for England?
Yes, it could. And how appropriate would that be after waiting 60 years? I didn't think we would be waiting 60 years, quite frankly, with us as a major footballing country to win the World Cup.
And the man leading England to the next World Cup is Mr. Thomas Tuchel. What do you reckon to that appointment?
Well, you can talk about the pros and cons of his appointment. It comes down to this. If England win, he's terrific. If we get knocked out in the first round, he's rubbish. It's really as simple as that.
Nothing to do with nationality? Did you see the comments from Harry Redknapp, Chris Wilder, objecting a little bit to a German leading England?
If you look at most of the other nationalities in football terms, a lot of the bosses are the same nationality as the country. So I haven't been really in favour of that. And I can understand their comments, particularly if you're talking about communication, which is absolutely vitally important in any senior management job. The thing about football, who knows? When a guy takes over a club or the national team, you don't really know. That's the beauty of the game.
Certainly is. That is Sir Jeff Hurst speaking to me earlier. His new book is called The Last Boy of 66, and there will be much more from him in the next hour of the programme.
Mike, thank you.
I have more diamonds than the Queen of England.
Welcome to the world of thieves and hoaxers and con women.
She does sound fabulous, though.
Massive dogs, lots of cars.
But who are these lady swindlers? And did they get away with their frauds and deceptions by using their feminine characteristics?
I am the notorious Tilly Devine.
She's a bit of a one-off, really.
Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley.
Where true crime meets history.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather now. Outbreaks of rain for much of the UK today. It'll be drier in northern Scotland and dry for many in the south later with sunshine.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in Ipswich, Justin Webb in London, alongside at 24 minutes to 8, Tom Sanders with the news.
An investigation by BBC News has found evidence that small boats used to ferry migrants across the Channel are being hidden in warehouses in western Germany. An undercover reporter was told by criminals that the equipment was kept in multiple sites in the city of Essen. The King has urged a summit of Commonwealth leaders in Samoa to commit to learning the lessons of the past, but did not directly address the issue of reparations for slavery. He said it was time to find creative ways to right inequalities that endure in the 56 countries that belong to the organisation. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in London for talks with Arab foreign ministers about de-escalation in the Middle East. In Qatar last night, he said mediators would reconvene there after weeks of stalled negotiations over a truce in Gaza. Dozens of people are said to have been killed or wounded in the latest Israeli airstrikes in northern Gaza. And in southern Lebanon, state media say two journalists and a technician were killed in an Israeli attack. Israel hasn't commented. A Los Angeles judge will consider whether two brothers who've spent more than three decades in prison for killing their parents should be resentenced, a move which could lead to their eventual release. Eric and Lyle Menendez were initially sentenced to life without parole, despite arguing they'd been physically and sexually abused by their father. Last year, new evidence was revealed, which backed up the brothers' claims. Kate Bush has told this programme she's really ready to do something new 13 years after her last studio album. In a rare interview to mark the release today of an animation she's helped create for the charity War Child, the singer-songwriter says she has lots of ideas.
Thank you, Tom. 22 minutes to 8. Now, one of the reasons the Chancellor may want to be able to borrow more in her budget next week is to help pay for the 1.5 million homes the government says it wants to build. Ministers are going to increase the house building targets that local councils have to meet. I'm broadcasting from Ipswich this morning, where the front pages of both local papers highlight the issues. The Star and the East Anglian Daily Times focus, on the one hand, on the soaring rents that are being paid in this town, and on the other, on opposition from local communities to building more. So I spent the day here yesterday looking at where houses are and where they're not being built.
We're looking at a field adjoining a housing development, which currently has got two horses in it, and it's being used as a paddock. But basically,
I've come to a field on the edge of Ipswich, which could be the site of 80 new homes. Could be, if local councillors hadn't blocked the development, including nine local Labour councillors. Amongst them, my guide, Councillor Colin Cridewolf.
The feeling of the committee was they were generally supportive of the concept of having up to 80 houses. What they were unhappy with was the mode of access.
You know the word they sometimes use, Colin, NIMBY. Are you a NIMBY?
No, I don't think so. I would have supported this application if the road to get to the site was from the other direction rather than through a small cul-de-sac, which is inappropriate.
So it's an argument about how rather than an argument about whether.
That's correct, yeah.
One of the big changes coming, we're told, is an increase to the targets. The target now is 466 homes a year. Yeah. It's going to 755 a year. Are you saying we can't deliver that?
I'm saying it will be very, very difficult because we don't have the land supply available to build on.
There are people who say Labour talks the talk at national level about building, not blocking, about building hundreds of thousands of homes. But in a place like Ipswich, here we are, nine local Labour councillors block a development of 80 homes. At a local level, Labour isn't delivering.
Well, at the planning committee that you're referring to, we have blocked the details as were presented to us at that committee.
So it's not that Labour's being two-faced, being bold nationally and being very cautious locally?
No, it's trying to achieve a balance because, you know, if you set a policy nationally, it tries to take account of all circumstances. Well, there are different circumstances pervading in local situations, which you need to take account of as well. And that is the purpose of having local planning committees. Otherwise, don't have local planning committees.
Just up the road here, they are building. They're digging. They're preparing for more than 1,100 new homes. 100 have so far been built. This is part of a huge new development on the edge of the Suffolk countryside, on the outskirts of Ipswich. It's called the Ipswich Garden Suburb Project. And eventually, there'll be 3,500 new homes in total. They first talked about building here, the neighbours say, 50 years ago.
I'm Sam Stafford, I am Planning Director at the Home Builders Federation. We are on the site of a pretty typical urban extension to a pretty typical, you know, reasonably sized town in England. 1,100 homes, primary school, local centre, community park.
So for a government in a hurry to build houses, they'll be concerned about delays. How long does it take to get planning permission, even on a site like this?
The local plan will have taken years. Then you will prepare an outline planning permission. I think on here that took 18 months. You then have the detail of where the access arrangements are going to be, what the road surfaces look like, where the landscaping look like, and what the houses look like. Each of those submissions will take 18 months. So if the government is wanting to build houses in 5 years' time, permissions need to be granted right now.
So we've gone from having a government that was under huge pressure from its own backbenchers not to build, to one that says it's in favour of building, not blocking. Are you and the house builders noticing the change?
The change in mood and sentiment and tone, and dare I say also leadership, is quite stark. The mood at the Labour conference seemed to be that, you know, the Labour YIMBY crowd was there, and it was very much a pro-housing sense. Locally, there tends to be more votes, in my experience, in opposing housing, or opposing anything indeed, especially in the run-up to a local election. And so it's that mood and that sentiment that needs to change to make a meaningful difference.
We were objecting to 80 houses on an agricultural field on the edge of our village. I'm Rupert Herries, and I'm the co-founder of East Suffolk Planning Alliance.
When you hear Keir Starmer talk about being a builder, not a blocker, does it worry you?
It doesn't worry me. We're certainly not blockers. We are not calling for the stoppage in housing or a halt on housing. We are calling for the right houses in the right locations.
Isn't that a version of NIMBY, which is you want housing but not in my backyard, you want it in someone else's backyard?
There are lots of examples where the locations are absolutely inappropriate, and that's normally because of access problems and also the fact that it's on agricultural land, often on the outskirts of villages.
The government are saying that if councils, like here in Suffolk, don't meet their housing targets, Whitehall will step in, will force the pace. How does that make you feel?
It's very, very worrying, because the original Levelling Up Act specifically states that local communities have to have involvement and engagement, and obviously that completely disenfranchises them.
Many community groups fear, many house builders hope, that this government really is going to be different, that it means what it says when Keir Starmer insists he wants to build and not to block. And yet, I've reported on politicians for decades, of all political colours, who have declared how determined they are to build hundreds of thousands of homes a year. And the real test is not what they say, but what actually happens on the ground in towns like this one.
And with those words, we come to 8:15 and to some news that we've been getting this morning from our business editor, Simon Jack, who is on the line, because there seems to be a significant development when it comes to Thames Water, the huge water company that is trying to avoid going into special administration. Simon, what have you discovered?
So this morning, Justin, Thames Water's been thrown a cash lifeline that will tide it over till this time next year. Now, the fears were growing that Thames would run out of cash by Christmas. As you say, that would have seen it placed in special administration under managers appointed by the government. But a short-term cash loan of up to £3 billion, first instalment of £1.5 billion, has been extended to the company at a high interest rate of nearly 10% by creditors. And what I think this shows is that people think there is a deal to be done here for Thames. It's been on the brink of bankruptcy for some time. It's drowning in debt of over £16 billion at the regulated entity and more elsewhere. And they haven't been able to secure the bill rises they wanted to. So people say, what's going to happen to this? A combination of this cash to tide them over for a while, giving them some time. Indications by Ofwat, which I reported earlier this week, that their bill rises will be allowed to rise by more than previously thought. And a number of, and the current creditors saying they are prepared to take some pain. You can then bring in investors, and some sort of market-led solution does look possible. Not certain, but I think hopes are rising that you won't have this quasi-nationalisation.
But people will be really interested in the idea that bill rises are part of this, because of course that would be the thing, wouldn't it, that would secure future investment. And it's not just Thames, it's right across the board, isn't it? But exactly, when you talk to the Environment Secretary
the other day who just said, well, let our review take its course. But there isn't any real doubt, is there, that in the end, the sins of the past are going to be paid for by customers.
Exactly right. I mean, at the moment, the industry wants something like a 40% on average rise, although it varies widely by region. At the moment, they've been offered like something like 21, about half of that. All the indications are that the Ofwat will soften its stance on that, part of it because the Environment Agency says there are some things you actually have to do, so they will have to pass those through. But as you rightly say, in a way, the commission that they've set up with Sir John Clunliffe to report back in about 6 months' time is a neat way of doing this. The government doesn't want to deliver the unhappy news that bill rises have got to go. It also doesn't want to overrule a supposedly independent regulator. The commission can do a lot of that for them. But as you say, one-way traffic, bills are going to be higher, and probably quite significantly.
Simon Jack, thank you.
It's now 12 minutes to 8, and it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the the Rector of St James's Piccadilly, the Reverend Lucy Winkett. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning. This week, thanks to new technology, a series of etchings engraved on copper plates by the poet and artist William Blake around 250 years ago has been revealed for the first time, a find that has excited artists and historians alike. I was particularly interested because William Blake, that writer with such colossal imagination, whose excoriating criticism was of society and church in his own day, was baptised at St James's Piccadilly, where I now serve. The etchings found, which he made as an apprentice, are like all etchings, painstakingly made. Using the point of a stylus, making grooves into wax on top of a copper plate, then applying acid to bite into the plate itself, transferring the image onto paper with ink. The thing about etching is that you can't erase anything. Once you've made the mark, you've made it. But you can make change, even fundamental change, by making more marks. In one famous etching of the Crucifixion of Christ by Rembrandt, multiple iterations show the development of many changes in the people, in the animals, in Christ himself. Rembrandt has done this not by erasing anything, but by making more marks, many more, joining the original lines to other lines so that a new picture emerges. Rembrandt himself said that life etches itself onto our faces as we grow older, showing our violence, excesses, or kindnesses. In these challenging times, our human capacity for violence, excess, and yes, kindness, is etched onto the life of the world, our societies, the planet. For individuals and communities, the marks we've made on each other, on the world, cannot be unmade. The past cannot be changed, however hard we try to retell it or make it seem better than it was. As the prophetic writer James Baldwin commented back in 1972, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. This is true for the current debates about the effects of climate change, the multiple legacies of the transatlantic chattel slave trade, and systemic injustices and inequalities that persist now. Just as much as it is for every one of us as individuals, as we come to terms with what we have done, who we have been, and how we make change for the future. Artists are not always historians or theologians. Their practice teaches us that our past is etched into our present, but that this can be a source not of despair, but of hope. Because change is always possible as a result of the decisions we make today. And today is what we have, creatively, to make our mark.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett. It brings us to 9 minutes to eight. Bob Woodward, the veteran US reporter who brought down Richard Nixon, has a new book. It's called War. It's on the presidency of Joe Biden mainly, but more importantly, perhaps, it's about Donald Trump as well and his behaviour and his fitness for office, or lack of such fitness, as Bob Woodward has been telling me.
He doesn't understand the presidency and its responsibilities. Once I asked him, what's the job of the president? He said, to protect the people. If you see when he was president, he did the exact opposite. He does not have a team he works with. He just picks people up, drops them. When he was president, he had 5 secretaries of defense. There are hangers-on. There are people who come and go, but there's no substantial voice. And his own voice just is not substantial because it goes one way and then the other.
What do you say to those who say those weaknesses that you have outlined are also, in a sense, his strengths and the thing that attracts him to a lot of people?
Well, people may be attracted to it, but you can't run the country that way. When he was president, that last year of his presidency was the year of the coronavirus, and his handling of it was a moral felony. I remember asking Trump once, well, have you talked to Fauci, Dr. Fauci, the infectious disease chief? Trump says, well, this is a busy White House. We don't have time.
Let me ask you this then. How much trouble is the world in if he wins?
I think the United States is in immense trouble, and clearly the world is. A president needs to find a way to discover the national interest. What does the country need? Trump cannot separate that national interest from his self-interest.
What a lot of his supporters say, his weaknesses are also his strengths, and in a sense also the things that attract him to people politically. Is any of that a fair point to make, do you think?
Oh, well, of course it is for lots of people. The pyrotechnics of Trump. I got to know him very well, talking to him for hours, and he can be charming. But being president is an organizational problem, not a charm problem.
But what a commentary, Bob, when you think of the American political class who you've reported on down the years, what a commentary on them that they can't convince the American people of what you've just told us.
Trump has captured the Republican Party, and so people are marching to him, and he's marching the country and the Republican Party off a cliff.
So what happens to us all if he's elected?
Joe Biden has said publicly he doesn't think there's going to be a peaceful transfer of power. Particularly if Trump loses, he's got those supporters who may turn to other means, as has happened before.
That was Bob Woodward. What Trump's supporters say is that all of this is hysteria, essentially. I've been talking to Sam Nunberg, political advisor to the 2016 Trump presidential campaign, to get his reaction. First, to the idea that Donald Trump doesn't really understand the presidency, the roles and responsibilities of being president of the United States.
Look, when I worked for Donald Trump, I was working under the paradigm that he wanted to win the primary. And he wanted to at least be very competitive in the general election. And when I had spoken to him after later in the process, after a short reconciliation, there was really no forethought into being president. I think there has been a dynamic change now. He is much more interested in policy. He has put a lot of thought into staffing. He has more experience, and he'll even admit to the closest you can get Donald Trump to admit to making a mistake. He'll say that this term would be much more effective because when he first won, as he says, I didn't know anybody and I was given a lot of, he'll call them rhinos, Republicans in name only, for staffing. But what Woodward is quasi-correct on here, Justin, is the fact that he's also running. He needs to win so that these criminal trials are all thrown out. If he loses, I do think that he would still be prosecuted in D.C., and I'm not sure President Harris would pardon him.
How worried are you that John Kelly's former long-serving chief of staff, former Marine general as well, says he was authoritarian, he admires people who are dictators, and specifically says he falls into the general definition of fascist. And that's someone who's worked very closely for him while he was in the Oval Office.
Do I believe that Donald Trump was praising Hitler to John Kelly? I frankly do not. Do I believe that that Donald Trump had a problem with understanding when he was first elected president in 2017 that you can't just simply do things? He wasn't in Trump Tower. These aren't real estate or business deals. I certainly do. I wouldn't say that he was a fascist. What I would say was that he was a novice.
If he loses, what will he do, do you think, and his supporters in the immediate aftermath?
I would just say that I'm talking to you thinking that Donald Trump is trending on winning it. But whether he does or whether Harris does, this is going to be extremely close. We're talking about these critical seven battleground states, some of them being decided by less than 50,000 votes, by less than 20,000 votes in some cases. I think that we're going to have a prolonged litigation. I think that they may try to do recounts. I don't know, but he's not in the Oval Office this time, so he's not going to be able to try to delay any transition. If you're asking, will he accept that he lost? I do not believe he would, but I also don't think that this is a January 6th type of situation.
Sam Nungbo, thank you very much for talking to us.
2 minutes to eight, time to look ahead to any questions tonight. Here's Alex Forsyth.
Good morning, Nick. Tonight we are in the northeast of England in Sunderland. That upcoming budget, of course, the backdrop. And on our panel, we have the Education Minister, Catherine McKinnell, the former Conservative Party chairman, Sir Jake Berry, the associate editor of The Spectator, Rod Liddell. And as the question of reparations comes up at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa, we have Eleanor Shearer, who writes about the legacy of slavery in the Caribbean and also works for the think tank Commonwealth. Hope you can join us. We will be live at 8 p.m.
Alex, thank you. To the weather, Simon King.
Justin, thanks so much indeed. We've got some rain at the moment across Northern Ireland, Wales and southwest England. That rain is going to ease off as it moves further north and eastward. There'll be then some sunny spells developing in southwest England, Wales, into central southern England is into the afternoon. With that, some blustery showers moving in as well. There could be a little bit of rain elsewhere, further north and east across Scotland, through northern and eastern areas of England. But we've also got some mist and fog this morning, which will slowly clear away. It will stay fairly cloudy across most of these areas, but in the southeast later into the evening we'll see some clearer skies developing. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 14, 15, 16 degrees Celsius for many, but up to about 19 or 20 Celsius across eastern areas of England. Pretty mild for the time of year. Over the weekend, Saturday looking dry with some sunshine for most of us, rain in the far north and the west. By Sunday, sunshine for most of us. And just a quick reminder that on Sunday, the clocks go back. So our sunset on Sunday will be around about 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the evening.
Thanks, Simon. You're listening to Radio 4, Justin Webb and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday the 25th of October. The headlines this morning. A BBC investigation has found evidence in Germany of the industrial scale of the cross-channel people smuggling operation using small boats. We'll hear that undercover report after the news. A fresh push is being made to revive talks on a ceasefire and a hostage deal in Gaza. And in a rare interview, Kate Bush tells this programme she's ready to start work on her first studio album for 13 years.
I'm very keen to start working on a new album when I've got this finished. I've got lots of ideas. I'm really looking forward to getting back into that creative space. It's been a long time.
The full interview with Kate Bush is going to be at about 20 past eight.
Yeah, we can all share the excitement then. And also in the next hour of the programme, the gap between the numbers of richer and poorer students going to university is at its highest level in more than a decade. Why is it widening? And we'll hear the choir made up of human and machine voices.
This world creates a...
That is all after the BBC News, read this morning by Tom Sanders.
An investigation by BBC News has found evidence that small boats used to ferry migrants across the Channel are being hidden in warehouses in western Germany. An undercover reporter was told by smugglers that the equipment was being stored in multiple sites in the city in Essen. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports.
This year has already become the deadliest for migrant crossings on the English Channel, according to a United Nations agency. The supply line for these boats stretches far back into Europe. our undercover journalist, who posed as a Syrian man hoping to get to Britain, met and exchanged messages with two smugglers in the West German city of Essen. They offered him a deal, €15,000 for a dinghy, engine and 60 life jackets to be delivered to the Calais area. They told him they had about 10 warehouses around Essen storing equipment that had come via Turkey. Britain's National Crime Agency says Germany's become a central location for the storage of small boats. Cities like Essen are close but not too close to northern France's more heavily monitored beaches. The German and UK governments say cooperation to crack down on the gangs behind this trade is good or accelerating.
The UK's biggest water company, Thames, is to borrow up to £3 billion to ensure its survival over the next year. Sources say the funding will give the firm time to restructure its debt and avoid the threat of administration. The company has previously warned it could run out of funds by Christmas if the majority of its lenders did not approve further borrowing to keep it going. Efforts are being made to restart negotiations on a ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. US and Israeli officials are set to head to Qatar for talks this weekend. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the UK today to meet Arab foreign ministers. Our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman is travelling with him.
The Americans say the talks in London are an opportunity to capitalise on Israel's killing of the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar and are aimed at preventing a further expansion of the war. But the US, which at once arms Israel while trying to rein in the current military trajectory, is making only marginal diplomatic gains. In Qatar, Mr. Blinken said mediators would reconvene for the first time in weeks to try to revive the lapsed negotiations for a truce in Gaza. Pressed by the BBC over accusations of possible war crimes by the Israeli military in northern Gaza, Mr. Blinken did not directly address the claims, but said the US rejected any effort to create a siege, to starve people, or to hive off the north from the rest of the territory. Today he will meet foreign ministers from Jordan and the UAE, as well as the Lebanese Prime Minister, trying to de-escalate the regional war and work on a post-conflict plan for Gaza.
The King has urged Commonwealth countries to commit to learning the lessons of the past at the opening of a meeting of the organisation's leaders in Samoa. Some members of the 56-nation group, made up mainly of former British colonies, wants a discussion about reparations for slavery. King Charles, who's head of the Commonwealth, didn't directly reference the matter in his speech, but said it was time to find creative ways to right inequalities that endure. The government has rejected suggestions that the UK should pay reparations. Our correspondent Katie Watson reports from Samoa.
King Charles told the Commonwealth leaders that it was vital to understand the group's history. I understand, he said, from listening to people, how the most painful aspects of our past continue to resonate. Where inequalities exist, we must find the right ways and the right language to address them. There are growing calls for the UK to address the issue of reparatory justice over the transatlantic slave trade. The government said it won't be apologising or considering financial reparations, but other Commonwealth nations want to start the conversation. King Charles also spoke about climate change. We are all well past believing it is a problem for the future, he said. If the issue isn't addressed, then inequalities across the Commonwealth and beyond will only be exacerbated, with the potential to fuel division and conflict.
A judge in California will rule on whether to release the brothers Eric and Lyle Menendez, who've served more than 3 decades in jail for the murder of their parents. They alleged that their father, a media executive, had sexually abused them, and their first trial in the mid-1990s attracted media attention across the US. Now, prosecutors have asked the courts to re-sentence the pair, raising the possibility they could be freed. Our Los Angeles correspondent Emma Vardy reports.
The murders at the family's Beverly Hills mansion in 1989 gripped the world. During their initial trial, which was televised, Eric and Lyle Menendez said they'd been physically and sexually abused by their father and argued the killings were manslaughter because they were in danger. It ended with a hung jury. Then in a subsequent trial, they were convicted and sentenced to life without parole. But last year, new evidence was revealed which backed up the brothers' claims of abuse. Now the district attorney for LA, George Gascon, has recommended that the brothers be given a lighter sentence, which means they could walk free.
They have been in prison for nearly 35 years. I believe
that they have paid their debt to society, and the system provides a vehicle for their case to be reviewed by a parole board.
Eric and Lal Menendez recently gained widespread attention with two Netflix series made about the case, which some say would have been treated differently by the courts nowadays, given modern understanding of sexual abuse. A judge will now make the final decision as to whether they will be released from jail.
It's emerged that inspections of tower blocks after the Grenfell disaster are finding a widely used cladding system has not been installed properly in some cases, calling into question its ability to resist a fire. It was not one of the types of cladding banned after Grenfell, despite having a checkered safety record around the world, which has been known about by successive governments. Phil Hendry reports.
Thousands of tower blocks are receiving independent fire safety inspections following the Grenfell Tower fire. What's been discovered are problems with a system known as rendered EPS. In effect, polystyrene insulation sprayed with a fire retardant and covered in a thin layer of cement render. It can pass lab fire tests if fitted with fire breaks of a non-flammable material between floors. But inspections have revealed this often didn't happen when EPS was actually installed in flats. The last government rejected calls for testing EPS alongside the ACM cladding that was on Grenfell and other panel-based cladding facades that have since been banned. The Ministry of Housing says it's monitoring the situation.
The government's chief scientific advisor is predicting a big revolution in products made using what's known as engineering biology. Professor Dame Angela McLean has told BBC News the technology will help reduce pollution from manufacturing. More from our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh.
Engineering biology involves harnessing and adapting the power of nature to produce many of the things we need. One approach is to grow materials or foods from microorganisms, for example, as an alternative to leather to produce handbags and shoes, and as egg and dairy substitutes, which are fat-free, but when used to make cakes, have the same taste as their full-fat alternatives. Both these products and many others can be produced more sustainably than the original. Professor Dame Angela McLean thinks that the science could transform our lives.
It really excites me because I feel like we are seeing the beginning of a big revolution that will make a lot of manufacturing much less polluting now and much more sustainable for the long run, all of which are problems we do need to solve.
Critics, though, warn that the benefits of engineering biology are often overstated, and it can also be used to create dangerous weapons as well as sustainable products.
Kate Bush has told this programme she's really ready to do something new 13 years after her last studio album. In a rare interview to mark the release today of an animation she's helped create for the charity War Child, the singer-songwriter says she has plenty of ideas. Our arts correspondent David Sillitoe has been listening.
I was born.
Set to Kate Bush's Snowflake, Little Shrew was created to highlight the impact of war on children.
In a cloud.
The song is from her last album, released 13 years ago. But speaking to Emma Barnett, she says she now feels ready to return to the studio.
I'm very keen to start working on a new album when I've got this finished. I've got lots of ideas. I'm really looking forward to getting back into that creative space. It's been a long time.
However, 10 years after her last live performance, when asked about returning to the stage, she said she wasn't there yet.
David Sillitoe.
Tom, thank you. It is now 8:10. Stop the boats is a slogan beloved of those enraged by the sight of migrants crossing the channel to seek a new life here. The past few years, though, have shown just how complex it is to actually stop them, not least because people smuggling is such a profitable business. This morning, a BBC investigation shines a light on when many of those boats used to make that hazardous journey are stored in Germany. In a meeting, our team covertly filmed two smugglers revealing how dinghies and engines are being kept in secret warehouses around the city of Essen. It's part of a network that runs from Turkey, where the boats are made, through Germany, where they're stored, and then on to northern France, where they are launched to make that journey across the channel. Our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker, has the story.
A boat engine is fired up in a video sent by a smuggler to our undercover journalist, who's posing as a Syrian migrant hoping to get to Britain. He's wearing a secret camera when we drop him off in Essen city centre, West Germany.
I'm sure I don't need to say this, but if you do feel at all uncomfortable, you just go. It's not a problem.
Months of groundwork have led up to this moment. Our guy is just a couple of streets away having a meeting with his contact. We've got a tracker on him. We're parked up here. We don't want to get too close. That could compromise things. But we've got to be close enough in case there's a problem and we have to get him out of there.
OK, so, yeah, tell us what happened.
Due to strict German law, we recorded the video, not the sound of this meeting. So our journalist is telling me what happened right after.
I met with the contact, Abu Sahar. We went to the cafe and sat outside. Then Abu Sahar tells me, lower your voice. He is coming. It's a man called Al-Khal, which means the uncle. Like the boss. Big respect.
For his safety, his recollections are voiced by a BBC producer.
They took my phone. Al-Khal started asking questions. Who are you? What are you planning? I want to know all about you.
Our man seems to win their trust as the smugglers reveal details of their network.
They tell me the equipment comes from Turkey. They have about 10 warehouses around Essen. Police raided one a few days ago, but they separate their stock and give the bait to police.
This testimony is backed up by messages and voice notes where the main smuggler contact, Abu Sahar, discusses certain engine models and known migrant crossing points. The videos he shared include a boat out on the water, set to music. It's like an advert.
Well, I don't think anybody should be in a boat like that.
Neil Dalton, chair of the National Independent Lifeboat Association, has looked at the footage.
I think death trap is probably a very good description of it. The boat isn't designed to take 50 people or even 60 people. You know, it's just not designed for that. It's definitely not suitable for trying to cross the channel in. It's appalling.
Britain's National Crime Agency has confirmed to us that Germany's a central location for storing boats that are eventually used in channel crossings, something our investigation brings to light. Because cities like Essen are just a few hours' drive from the Calais region, but not too close to its more heavily monitored beaches. While under German law, helping to smuggle people out of the EU to a third country like the UK isn't technically illegal. Even so, the Germans have helped carry out raids and arrests.
But have they stepped up to the extent that the French have, for example? No, they haven't.
Tuesday Reitano is from the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime.
But I would say also this is a fact that this is a relatively new problem for them. They haven't been an active site for the Channel crossing up until recently. And the French have been given an enormous amount of both time and resources and political pressure to be a strong partner in the fight against organised immigration crime across the Channel. We haven't yet made the same efforts with the Germans.
Back at the cafe, it's down to business.
The smuggler says one option. I can get you a boat. You will pay me 15,000 euros. You will get the boat with 60 life jackets and all the equipment, guaranteed delivery to the Calais area. They tell me they have a new crossing point. No one knows about it.
From West Germany to here, the shores of northeastern France, where you can find deflated boats that look very like the ones we've seen pictures of, the remnants of failed and sometimes fatal attempts to get to Britain, while gangs, as we've shown, continue to make big money from this misery.
Jess Parker reporting that. Listening to her reports are David Normington, former Permanent Secretary at the Home Office, and Rob Laurie, familiar voice on the programme now, former soldier turned aid worker working with refugees, and one of those behind the award-winning Radio 4 podcast series To Catch a Scorpion. I know I say this every time, but if you've not listened, please do. It's worth all those awards. Rob, first of all, you know this German trade well. What have you seen?
Well,
pretty much your report there was very accurate. In and around Essen, it's not just Essen, it's the place like... it's all the Westphalian area, really. Duisburg, Dusseldorf, Bochum, Essen, Köln. There's many, many warehouses and even small garages and even garages attached to houses where boats are stored. And I think the right in pointing out the German legal system, it has a number of, you know, laws and regulations that govern surveillance. For instance, it's illegal to make covert audio recordings of private conversations, which I think your piece picked up quite nicely, only being able to describe the video. But it's not hard. Take me, for instance, if I wanted to enter German territory on a flatbed open wagon with 21 boxed boats on the back of my, in full show, I could drive right across Germany. And the reason I could do that is because these networks, these smuggling networks, they actually set up legit tax-paying marine import companies. So if I get pulled over, I've got all the paperwork to say, look, my load of boats is legitimate, going to a legitimate tax-paying company. Now, Germany is a real central part to this in terms of the storage of boats right across the Westphalian area of, you know, of
the
land.
And is that, Rob, because it would be trickier to do the same thing in France?
Yeah, I think the laws are different in France, and I think the covert surveillance... In order, you've got to prove conspiracy to commit a criminal act, and that is so difficult, especially when the German constitution doesn't allow any kind of covert surveillance in terms of bringing these to book. So it's quite...
Rob, that's very clear. Let me turn now to Sir David Norman. I might come back to you, but Sir David, listening to that... You can see the problem for any British government, can't you? Which is, you've got to somehow, have you, persuade the Germans not just to cooperate, as they clearly do in intelligence and police. We've got statements from the British and German government stressing how well they cooperate together, but potentially to change the laws there.
Yes, and I think that is very difficult and probably not going to happen. So I think you have to concentrate on the things that can be done. One of the things that Rob's investigation showed was that these networks stretch from a corner shop in Nottingham right through to Iraq, and the National Crime Agency undoubtedly will be analysing every step of that way, and will be looking at the places where it can take action. Some action can be taken in Germany, as we heard from the report, but there will be some limitations on it. And that's why a lot of the emphasis has been on relations with the French, where actually a lot of progress has been made. Not enough, but there's more to do. But a lot of progress has been made in building relations with the French and working together with them on this really intractable problem.
So if you were back in your old job, top official advising the Home Secretary, you might express some frustration at listening to a report like that. Would you say, look, honestly, Home Secretary, you're never going to get the Germans to change the law. They've got enough problems of their own dealing with illegal migration across their borders.
I might say that privately, but I might also advise the Home Secretary to go to Berlin and to see what can be done. I think there's probably quite a lot that can be done. Relations with Germany are very good at the moment. There's just been a very good new defence pact with them. There will be things that can be done working with their law enforcement agencies and their intelligence services. I think in this process, it's important to look at what can be done, not to talk about pressure on Germany, but to talk about partnership and cooperation. I think things can be done. It's very, very difficult, but it's not hopeless.
And I sense from what you're saying that your message, if you were still advising the Home Secretary, indeed to any minister who might be listening, is it's all about small incremental steps, not grand big gestures.
That is what I've always believed about this. I think we've seen those grand gestures, like the Rwanda policy, which didn't get off the ground. I think that this requires serious, determined work by politicians, by law enforcement agencies, by intelligence services. It will be very difficult, but I think some progress can be made.
Sir David Normington, thank you. Last word then to you, Rob, listening to that. It's not your job to advise politicians, but if you were, given what you know, what would you tell them about this problem?
Well, it's not going away anytime soon. It is a very British problem, isn't it? I mean, I'm more concerned about deaths in the Channel than, you know, refugees seeking a better life. So I think it's summed up nicely. It's small incremental steps making relationships around Europe. And to be fair, over the last 5 years, we haven't been best at that.
Yeah, and if that's done, it might be possible to have fewer of those boats stored successfully in Germany, you think, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, it's down to Germany, that is. We need to encourage Germany to actually change the constitution whereby they can actually, you know, make arrests on this. At the moment, it's very, very difficult. And why would they throw German taxpayer money at a very British problem at the moment?
Couldn't be clearer. Rob Laurie, thank you. And Sir David Normington, former Permanent Secretary of the Home Office.
22 minutes past eight, as you've been hearing, Emma has an exclusive interview, a very rare interview, with Kate Bush. Here is what she has to say about it before we hear the interview itself.
This week, I had the rare pleasure of sitting down with Kate Bush and her cat to watch a new short animated film she's made called Little Shrew. It tells the tale of an animal caught up in war, trying to survive, and is out today. It's set to her haunting and beautiful song, Snowflake, and is created to support the charity War Child, which helps children caught up in conflict, a cause Kate has supported over the years. Her decision to make the animation was prompted by the outbreak of war in Ukraine, and she felt moved to create something and began work with an illustrator. Kate Bush has sold 20 million albums around the world and was 19 when she released her first single, Wuthering Heights, becoming the youngest woman to have a self-written number one in the UK. In 2022, a whole new audience discovered Kate Bush through the TV series Stranger Things with the use of her hit single Running Up That Hill, sending it back to the top of the charts 37 years after it was first released. And, excitingly, tantalisingly, in this interview, as you will hear, Kate Bush is ready to start working on a new album, saying it's been a long time, but she's ready to create something new. But first, we started by talking about her new film.
So I started working on it over a couple of years ago, and it was not long after the Ukrainian war broke out. I think it was such a shock for all of us. You know, it's been such a long period of peace that we've all been living through. And I just felt that I really wanted to make a little animation that would feature originally a little girl. It was really the idea of a child and children that are caught up in war. I wanted to draw attention to, you know, how horrific it is for children. And so I came up with this idea for a little storyboard and felt that actually it would be more, people would probably be more empathetic towards a little creature rather than a human. I came up with the idea of it being a little shrew.
I mean, I think that's fascinating, that perhaps sometimes some people's empathy is bigger when they see a defenceless animal in a situation versus even a child.
I mean, I think to a certain extent we've all become really desensitized by the violence that we see in films all the time, you know, where people are just being slaughtered, really.
Yeah.
But if a dog were to be killed in a film, everyone would be up in arms. It's a terrible thing to say, but I think there is an element of truth in that.
With certainly the war in Ukraine, but I'm obviously now mindful of other wars and not least what's happened in the Middle East over the last 12 months. It's closer to home when that war broke out, like you say, and it was a surprise for some, not for others. But that peace on the continent of Europe and what we think about with our own stability, it did shake a lot of people to the core.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've all been through very difficult times. These are dark times that we're living in. And I think to a certain extent, everyone is just worn out. I mean, we went through the pandemic and that was a huge shock. And I think really we felt that once that was over, if you could ever say it was over, that we would all be able to sort of get on with some kind of normal life. But in fact, it just seems to be, you know, going from one situation to another, and more wars seem to be breaking out all the time.
I've had the luck to watch this, and to watch it with you, in fact, to see it just before it was ready. I know you were still tinkering with it. I hope I'm going to get this right. Is it a Caucasian pygmy shrew?
Yes,
Okay. Why the choice of that very small animal?
They're so tiny, and they're incredibly sweet, tiny little creatures. I had some encounters with shrews over the years because of my cats who would bring them in, and luckily, in most cases, they were still alive, so I'd be able to catch them and have a quick look at them before I put them out. And they're just incredibly cute little creatures, and they have these sort of... They have this nose, like this sort of long proboscis. It's almost like a little elephant's trunk that moves. It's very mobile and incredibly charming.
The animation is very cute, but it also brings home the vulnerability, the defencelessness of people in those situations. And it's very powerful with the song that you picked for it. I mean, when you wrote Snowflake, what were you trying to bring across? I was just looking at some of the lyrics. You know, one of them is, "The world is so loud, keep falling, I'll find you."
The world is so loud, keep falling, I'll find you.
What were you writing about?
Well, at the time, it was really something I'd written in order to feature my son, who was still a child at that point, and to capture his very beautiful descant voice before he grew up. The idea of this little snowflake falling to ground, and that this person then managed to find it and catch it amongst all the other millions of snowflakes that were falling. And a few people at the time said to them what they imagined the song to be was a mother and a soul who were looking to find each other. I thought it was a really beautiful image that actually a few people said that quite independently.
And then you thought perhaps it would work in this instance, the idea of finding each other amidst the rubble, but also sort of hope?
Yes, yes, very much so. I mean, that's one of the key features of the animation, is that there is hope. Hopefully there is hope. Mm. And it's something that I think we all need big time right now.
Just going back to something you said before about us becoming desensitized to the image and the visions and the scenes of violence. I mean, where do you think that goes? How do we sort of, I don't know, deal with that, do you think?
I mean, when you look at some of the imagery that's in films now, I despair.
Really?
I mean, I think you kind of wonder, why do people want to watch stuff like this? You know, it's strange times.
Do you think music and certainly film, though, to slightly flip that on its head, can perhaps send messages home that the news can't? You know, maybe makes you think about something that you are looking at, but maybe you've become desensitised to.
Not all films are violent or ugly. There are some incredible masterpieces out there, and the same with music. Mm. I think music is something that can bring hope to people. Very special stuff, music, and it's one of the... Well, I think it is the only art form, isn't it, that is invisible. All other art forms tend to work on a very visual plane. There's something about music, if it's something that talks to you, it can really get in deep, you know, really under your skin.
I think I would be personally held to some sort of very serious account by those listeners to the radio if I didn't ask if you've got some ideas for music at the moment. Are you working on any new material?
Not at the moment, but I've been caught up doing a lot of archive work over the last few years on all kinds of different levels, redesigning our website, putting a lyric book together, and I'm very keen to start working on a new album when I've got this finished. I've got lots of ideas. I'm really looking forward to getting back into that creative space. It's been a long time.
Really? Is it something that you've been wanting to do for a while?
Yeah, it is really, yes. I mean, I think... Particularly the last year, I felt really ready to start doing something new.
Wow. It will be music to many of your fans' ears to hear that.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a lovely thing to say.
Do you listen to a lot of music to get inspired yourself?
No, I don't really. No, I mean, what I tend to do is I watch a lot of films. I love watching films.
Your friend and early champion of yours, Dave Gilmour of Pink Floyd, was recently asked in a newspaper interview by a reader about whether he could get you back on stage soon. Did you see this? And he said, "Kate Bush is the only person who can get Kate Bush back on stage. I think the show she did in 2014 at the Hammersmith Apollo was some of the best I've seen. We went several nights. I've tried persuading her recently, actually, gently." How's that going?
I'm not there yet.
What do you think it is now about potentially wanting to make more music, new music again. Is there something that's sort of changed with you or some inspiration, if you don't mind me asking?
This animation has taken up a lot of time this year, so really once this is finished, I'll be ready to start anew.
Do you think it will be different? Do you know what comes out before it comes out? Do you have any idea of how it might sound?
I think it's got to be different, hasn't it? I like to think that all my albums are different from each other. And, yeah, I'm sure it will be different. I mean, we've all been through a lot the last few years, haven't we? So
I think what you said about, is it over? You know, I'm always mindful of post-lockdown, those who are still shielding, and also some of the longer-term impacts of that time and how it has changed how people socialise or how they don't or how they think about the world. I don't know if you can relate to any of that, but it's certainly something that perhaps many of us haven't processed yet.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're only just starting to come to terms with some of the effects that it's had. And I think, you know, it's like I said earlier, I think everyone's worn out. I also think everyone's kind of changed a bit since lockdown. I think it's really changed people. That and the combination of the bombardment of social media, which I don't really engage with, but I see it in a lot of my friends. You know, it's like people are very different.
How do you think you've changed?
How have I changed? I appreciate little shrews a lot more.
Is it a greater appreciation of nature?
You can stand outside and just look at the light, the sunlight. Like the other day was the most beautiful autumnal day. Mm. And all the trees were turning and the sunlight was like golden. And you just think, you know, it is a really incredibly beautiful world that we live in, if we're lucky enough to be able to see those parts of it.
And be safe and all of those things that we started by talking about. And just to your point about social media, I mean, seeing a beautiful sky and not feeling the need to reach for your phone, to actually take that moment in and be there is the other thing that we're not as good at anymore.
I think we all need to be working on that. To actually be present in the moment. Living your life through your phone is maybe not as exciting.
It's lovely to talk to you, Kate.
And you too. Thank you so much, Emma. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to give this animation, have some light shone on it. So thank you very much. And if people feel they could donate even just the tiniest amount to War Child or any other charity that deals with children caught up in war, that would be a really wonderful thing.
Kate Bush there, and exciting news about that new music that's coming in. There's another exclusive we've got for you here. Mike Williams has got it in the sport. Morning, Mike.
Morning, Nick. Yes, you can't move for exclusive interviews this morning from Kate Bush to Jeff Hurst in a moment, but first let me just tell you, spinner Rahim Ahmed is amongst the wickets for England. He's taken three this morning to help reduce Pakistan to 187 for seven at lunch on day two of the deciding test in Rawalpindi, meaning Pakistan still trail England's first innings total by 80 runs. You can follow the afternoon session when it gets underway in around 40 minutes over on Test Match Special. So as Nick said, let's hear now more from our exclusive interview with Sir Jeff Hurst. The 82-year-old is now the sole surviving member of England's World Cup winning side. He has spent the last 58 years recounting the events of the 30th of July 1966 and has been further reflecting on that life-defining day in a new book. I wanted to ask him if this country's fascination or perhaps obsession with 66 still amazes him.
It does. It's quite surprising. I think that the mere fact simply that we haven't achieved it since. I think had we done it a couple of times, I think ours would have faded into the distance. Because we haven't, we are still talking about it. I'm often asked, do I get fed up with it? And the answer is categorically no. That it was such a great day, you can understand people wanting to talk about it.
And you are now, as the book proclaims, the last boy of 66. That's quite a solemn accolade, isn't it? You have said goodbye to all 10 teammates who started with you in that match 58 years ago, starting with Bobby Moore in 1993 and most recently Bobby Charlton last year. How do you reflect now on being, as you say in the book, the lone survivor of a species facing extinction?
It's well put, isn't it, by the writer? It fills me with a great deal of sadness. Every time, every reflection, every picture I see, which I do see from time to time, of me with the team or me with one or two of the individuals doing certain things in old clips, with a great deal of sadness.
I was struck as well in the book that you talk openly about your own passing. I mean, you know, as we all do about ourselves, that one day our time will come. And you address this in the book, even giving instructions for your own funeral. No dignitaries, you say, only family.
Yes. That's right. That's my view. And I think it takes a great deal of stress off my wife. If you start inviting the world and his wife to it, she's going to be involved. And I think that would be hugely stressful for her.
One of the most striking passages for me in the book is in some of the final pages. You talk about winning the World Cup, the moments immediately after the final whistle, and you say, this is a quote, "The images of us celebrating will take their place in the nation's photo album, all of us arm in arm, smiling into the future. One day in that future, though we don't know it yet, we will sell the medals in our hands and the shirts on our backs whilst holding on to our memories of today, until half a dozen of us will lose those memories too." Dementia and related brain injuries continue to be the scourge of footballers from your generation, and several of your 66 teammates suffered from it terribly, Jack Charlton perhaps most famously. It is just a terrible sadness, isn't it?
Sadness is not a strong enough word for it, for everybody that's living with somebody that's got to that awful disease. And of course, it's not the person itself that's got the disease. They're not aware of it. It's the carers, the family, the close family members who are suffering very badly with it. Martin Peters, my next-door neighbour for a spell, he went through it as well, and my wife still talks to his wife, Kathy. So it is awful, not just our particular group of people, but for the world in general.
Has enough been done by the authorities to help those footballers with dementia, and has enough research been done in between the links of heading the ball and CTE?
I'm not sure. It's a difficult technical question to answer that. I think there was a view that footballers are 3.5 times more likely to suffer with dementia than the man in the street. But having said that, it's nowhere near the answer, because we all know people, men and women, who've never been near a football who are suffering from it as well.
Aside from the dementia, several of the players of 1966 also fell on hard times in other ways, didn't they? Alan Ball was one of many who had to sell their medals pretty early on. I mean, that compared to today, if you were to think of an England side winning a major tournament, it would just be unthinkable that players would have to do that.
Oh, I often talk about the medieval days, and I look back where the game is today and yesteryear with great amusement. My medals were sold. The story about that is I spoke to my three kids. Sadly, my oldest daughter passed away in 2010. I spoke to them about what they would like. I referred to the medals, that's what I meant. But my oldest daughter said, "Dad," she said, "that settee in the living room, I'd like that." within 2 or 3 weeks of that, I decided I was going to sell all the medals and give your kids the money when you're around. As not for one second do I regret doing that.
We talk about it being a different world these days as a professional footballer to back in your day. One of the anecdotes I love from the book is that you all went to the cinema the night before the final to watch. Do you remember the film?
Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines. How can you possibly forget that title?
And you went to the cinema almost unrecognised, didn't you?
Yes, we walked up the road. It was about a half a mile to a mile away. Watched the film. There was a break in between the films and walked all the way back. And there's not one autograph hunter or pressman anywhere within sight of us. Very amusing, eh? Unbelievable. Can you imagine that today?
When did you first hear Kenneth Walton-Holmes' famous commentary?
Any second now, it will all be over. And here comes Hurst. He's got some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is now. It's four.
Probably not long afterwards, and that's been part of the beauty as well. And that middle part of it, they think it's all over, is now part, as you know, as everyday language in all our walks of life. It is unbelievable commentary.
Well, Sir Geoff, they think it's all over, and it is now. Thank you so much for speaking to us on the programme.
Pleasure. Very enjoyable to talk all about all these years later. Again.
Can't quite believe that I actually used the "they think it's all over" line in front of Sir Geoff Hurst, but it felt right at the time, Nick, and he took it in good grace. Sir Geoff's new book, The Last Boy of 66, is out now. Imagine doing something age 24 and still be talking about it pretty much every day at the age of 82. Incredible.
Thank you very much, Mike. A quick word now about All in the Mind and their awards.
I'm Claudia Hammond, and I'd love to know, is there a person or a group who has made a real difference to your mental health? You can nominate them now for the All in the Mind Awards. For Josephine, winning in 2023 made her feel stronger.
The awards have given me a kind of extra superpower. It's a special recognition of a difficult task.
To enter and for full terms, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4/allinthemind. You have until 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 8th of January, 2025 to enter. Can't wait to read what you have to say.
Thank you for that quick look at the weather. Outbreaks of rain for much of the UK today, although it'll be drier in northern Scotland and drier for many in the south later with sunshine.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4, Nick Robinson in Ipswich, Justin Webb in London, and at 19 minutes to 9, we are late. Tom Saunders is here with the news.
A BBC investigation has found evidence that small boats used to ferry migrants across the Channel are being hidden in warehouses in western Germany. Smugglers told an undercover reporter there were multiple sites in one city, Essen. The former Home Office Permanent Secretary Sir David Normington has told this programme it would be difficult but not hopeless to work with the German authorities on a crackdown. The UK's biggest water company, Thames Water, has been offered a loan of up to £3 billion. The funding will tide the firm over until September next year. There had been fears it would run out of money by Christmas. Efforts are being made to restart negotiations on a ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. US and Israeli officials are set to head to Qatar for talks this weekend. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in London today to meet Arab foreign ministers. Prosecutors have paved the way for the possible release of Eric and Lyle Menendez, the brothers at the centre of one of America's most notorious murder cases. They've been in prison for more than three decades after being convicted of killing their parents in Los Angeles in 1989.
Thank you. It is 17 minutes to nine. A letter to the Times today from Lord Blunkett is going to be noted with interest and perhaps concern by all in the world of the Labour Party. Lord Blunkett is, of course, a party grandee, but is also a former Work and Pensions Secretary who introduced auto-enrolment of workplace pensions, a reform aimed at encouraging saving for retirement. He addresses the issue in the Times and told me why he's worried about the possible imposition of national insurance on employers' pension contributions.
Well, firstly, Justin, I've only got briefings to go on, and there have been multiple, far, far too many briefings for any of us, and I think it's dangerous. But if this one's correct, and there's a proposal next Wednesday to put national insurance on the pension contribution that employers pay, then what is the logical outcome of that? It is that employers will pay less in contribution to people's pension pot. And when Adair Turner came out back in 2005 with his commission report on recommending auto-enrolment, which I accepted as Work and Pensions Secretary, we did so on the basis that there was going to be a generation, unlike my own, who would have a rotten pension. In other words, their retirement would be miserable. And so I think we've got an obligation to encourage employers to pay as much as possible into the pension pot. And there's a different matter about the rate of national insurance for employers. That's a quite separate issue. But you don't disincentivize people from paying into and building a pension.
And you take it seriously, and this seriously, because you think there is no question that that being the impact that it has.
Well, from there's no question in my mind, and, you know, based on evidence, that is the problem, which is why auto-enrolment, which for listeners is the automatic contribution that employers now have to make into pension pots, that didn't exist. And it took several years to introduce it, sadly. But it now is up and running, and it has been for about 12, 13 years. And it makes such a difference to what people will inherit when they eventually retire. So we have an obligation to the next generation to do what we benefited from. And I think it's really important that whatever's going on inside the Treasury, and it's probably too late now to influence it, they must think long-term as well as short-term.
To which they would respond, if they were listening now, well, we've got to get this money from somewhere.
And I agree with that. I think that Rachel Reeves has been left a terrible hand. Well, firstly, you've got to be clear. Are you in favour of investment and growth? Are you in favour of orthodoxy and stability? Get that right and get the balance between that orthodoxy economically and the political imperative right, and you'll make the right decisions. Clearly, alterations to capital gains, which have been knocked about, some of which would raise substantial money without damaging anyone particularly, is a really good idea. There's all kinds of things that have been floated. Rachel's impossible task is to disseminate the right ones on Wednesday so that we get not just the picture of how we're going to meet the gap and how we're going to invest in our services, which are in a desperate state, but also the hope, the aspiration, and perhaps also the energy we need as a nation. I get the feeling that post-COVID, we are a tired nation, and more misery, more miserableness, as I've been calling it over the last few weeks, won't do.
But also separating out different groups of people and saying, you are a working person, you, on the other hand, are not a working person because you don't meet our definition. For you, is that wise policy? Is it wise politics?
Well, it's trying to differentiate. I meet people when I'm walking the dog up in Sheffield who say to me, am I a working person? I've just retired. And I don't have a particular answer to them, actually, because I'm supposed to be retired and I'm still working. So where are we? We've got to find a different phraseology. What's meant, of course, is those who actually earn an income as opposed to those who draw down on something, which in the jargon is called rent here. I think we've got to get this balance right as well, because get this balance wrong and you end up hitting those who have investments, and we need investment. I mean, that's the point. We need people who are saving so that other people can borrow. And that's true on a big scale in terms of pension pots. So getting the balance right is almost impossible. I'm afraid Rachel's got to pull that task off.
It's a tricky one, isn't it, to put it mildly. Do you agree with those who are saying this budget defines this parliament?
Yes, I do. And I think it will define whether we continue to lose dramatically by-elections and next year local elections across the counties and the year after in London and in Scotland. If you're going to get a second term to do what you really want to do on a long-term basis, then you have to keep a degree of popularity, because once you've lost it, as the Tories found, it takes a very, very long time to pull it back.
Lord Blunkett, David Blunkett, thank you very much.
Thank you.
9:12.
Peace walk creates a freedom.
Bach, Brahms, Handel, Vivaldi, they all wrote wonderful choral music. Can AI do anything similar? Can it, in fact, do it better? Well, a new exhibition at the Serpentine entitled The Call shows how artificial intelligence can enhance the power and the artistry of the voice. One of the artists behind the exhibition joins us on the line, Matt Dryhurst. Morning to you. Can it really enhance the power and artistry of the voice? All those composers did pretty damn well, didn't they?
Good morning. I guess the purpose of the exhibition is not to say, to kind of situate AI as something other, but rather to see these models as something that we all collectively train and will use going forward. The model that we trained is very much the product of the 15 choirs that contributed to it. And we see that as part of a lineage of choral music being a matter of contributing something greater than oneself.
That's interesting. So you're saying that the mindset that says AI is different, it's a computer, it's a machine, is wrong. It's the product of all of us.
I would argue that too. Yeah, we very much situate AI as kind of a monumental collective accomplishment. It's too often in shorthand presented as this alien other that learns by itself. But of course, it's learning from all of us, and it's kind of incumbent on us to, one, understand that going forward, all the media we produce is actually training these things, and also to think of the complicated IP implications. Because, you know, if indeed we are all contributing to this intelligence, we might want to enjoy some of the bounties of it.
Yeah, the exhibition, as I understand it, is not claiming that AI makes better music, but examining how we work and live with AI, what we get from it and how we should control it.
That's exactly the point. We're trying to think of a more beautiful way to train AI. So we wrote a songbook, humans wrote a songbook, that covers the full range of the English phonetic language, sufficient for a model to be able to understand a voice. And we took this songbook throughout the UK with 15 professional amateur choirs throughout the UK to create a data set that we then used to train a model in order to basically explicate and show people how these models are actually a product of us. They come from us, and they're actually pretty nifty at coming up with new things themselves.
Did the exercise of doing it change your view?
No, rather it kind of reinforced it. We've been working with machine learning for the best part of 10 years, and are really kind of really kind of adamant about this principle that we should start seeing these models as something that we all contribute to, that we all have some kind of shared ownership in. And so actually the process of going to these different choirs and speaking to them about the issues and seeing their willingness to actually participate when once their consent was invited kind of validated and reinforced my belief in where the stuff will go eventually.
Matt Dryhurst, the exhibition's called The Call. It's on at the Serpentine Galleries in central London. Thanks for joining us.
And that brings us to 9 minutes to nine. There is data out from the Department of Education that reveals that the gap between richer and poorer students at school going on to university, and particularly the more top-graded universities, is at its highest level since records began. And the proportion of children on free school meals attending top universities has seen its first annual decrease. Let us talk to Lee Elliott Major, Professor of Social Mobility at the University of Exeter. Professor, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's about COVID, isn't it? It's about lockdowns. Is it as simple as that?
I think this is more profound than that, actually. You know, if you look at all the dials, if you like, of social mobility, they're all flashing red at the moment. It's a kind of perfect storm of factors really affecting a whole generation. And this is about rising child poverty, which was happening pre-COVID, actually, but has sort of accelerated. And, you know, if I visit schools these days, there's usually a food bank, you know, next door, which I think is a real symbol of where we are. There is a crisis in chronic absenteeism in our schools. And on top of all this, you know, there is a crisis in student hardship on our campuses. You know, I've seen really heartbreaking stories of students, you know, too hungry, too cold to study, having to work, you know, all the hours. So sadly, I hate to say it to the listeners again, I know I've said this before, but I think we're going back as a society, and someone like me who was first in their family to go into higher education may not have applied in this current era. So it's really, really tragic.
On the poverty side of it, though, there are really interesting stats also in what the Department of Education has brought to us. So here is one. Twice as many girls of Chinese descent who are on free school meals, so in other words, in poor families, twice as many girls of Chinese descent on free school meals go to university than white British boys from affluent households. In other words, it's not just poverty, is it? Although poverty unquestionably will affect some families and will affect their decisions about going to universities, there is a cultural side to this.
Absolutely. You know, I would argue that cultural barriers are perhaps as important as material barriers in determining, you know, our life prospects. So I do think, and if you look at the statistics, I mean, one of the most depressing statistics is, you know, private school pupils are nearly twice as likely to get into those, you know, highly prestigious universities as their state school counterparts, even when those state school students have got their A-levels, right? So, so there is something more than poverty. You're absolutely right. I do think as a university system, we do need to do far more to make ourselves less alienating to those young people who just happen to come from different cultural and class backgrounds. You know, I still think it can feel like a very alienating experience.
But is it up to the, sorry to interrupt, Professor, is it up to the universities there or up to the parents and the cultures from where those children come from?
I think we can do more to work with the parents, no doubt about that. But I also think as an education system, we could be more accessible. You know, I would point out to the lack of an equitable sort of schools policy that we have in this country. So at the moment, you know, when schools get assessed by Ofsted, we don't look at how, you know, are those schools taking their fair share of vulnerable and under-resourced pupils? And are they doing well for those specific pupils? Yeah, you know, we tend to just rely on generic school improvement policies. So there is more the education system can do, but yes, you've got to address those bigger issues.
As ever, many thanks to you, Professor Lee Elliott Major from the University of Exeter.
Coming up later here on Radio 4, Tim Heap and Helen Chersky consider what environmental implications the upcoming US election could have on the planet. That's Rare Earth just after 12 today. And if you missed our interview with Kate Bush and the news, she's starting a new album, starting work on it. You can listen on BBC Sounds and get the whole story of that interview and the interview itself as well. Well, at 5 to 9, let us turn to life on Mars. With climate change and war and political anger and division down here on Earth, it could be quite tempting to go there. Elon Musk certainly wants to open up the possibility. But are space settlements possible? Are they a good idea? Questions that inspired a book that won the Royal Society Science Book of the Year. And we're delighted to be joined by the co-authors, Kelly Weiner-Smith and her husband, Zach Weiner-Smith. Although you're in different continents this morning, Kelly in the studio. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you so much. I still can't believe it.
Yeah, and Zach, you're at home in Virginia, I understand. This is an exciting time.
Yeah, I'm hiding outside my house so I don't wake my kids up.
And Kelly, look, you spent years, as I understand it, looking into this and concluding it wasn't all that appealing.
There's so much we still have left to learn about how bodies are going to respond in space, and Mars is so different than any environment we already have data for. What the astronauts experience on the International Space Station is very different than Mars. There's just so much we still have left to learn.
And Zach, you're a cartoonist rather than your wife's a biologist, as I understand it. What did you want to know and what did you find out?
Oh, gosh. Well, we hoped we could sort of help point the way forward for space settlements, which we thought were coming soon. And it just turned out to be much more difficult than advertised.
Kelly, give us an example. What's the problems that we might face?
Well, space radiation is very poorly understood. The astronauts on the International Space Station are protected by Earth's magnetosphere, so they don't encounter a lot of the space radiation, which is very different than the radiation we encounter on Earth. So we know very little about whether or you know, whether cancer risks are going to go up, what kind of impacts this could have on, you know, cognitive abilities. So that's one of many problems that we don't understand well enough.
And one question you ask, Zach, is whether you can make babies in space. It's a family show, but help us with the answer.
Yeah, I the short version is the fun part probably works. The 18 years that ensue are a pretty open question. And there's lots of reasons to worry. Low gravity probably causes problems for muscle and bone development. You may not know this, but the soil of Mars is full of perchlorates, a chemical used in dry cleaning, which has deleterious effects on hormones. So, you know, those are just a few among many problems that may make it impossible to actually have children on Mars.
And Kelly, I have to say, I hadn't thought of this question, but apparently it's central to the book. Why do astronauts love taco sauce? why do they?
For reasons we really don't understand, a lot of astronauts complain that foods are less flavorful when you're in space. And so they want the like spiciest, saltiest things so that they have, you know, something that they can taste. And so there was a shuttle mission where taco sauce packets were actually used as currency and they were traded like, you are, you know, if you clean the toilet for me today, I'll give you 4 taco sauce packets. So they really like spicy stuff.
Wow. That may tell you more about the astronauts than the sauce, I guess. And Zach, if somebody said now, if Elon Musk said, well, yep, we've cracked it, you can go, would you?
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't even do the rocket part. never mind the part where you stay on Mars. I mean, the you know, if you take all the trips ever to space, I think the rate of death is like close to 1%. I do believe it's much safer now, but it's still for daredevils.
Kelly, what about you?
No, I'm a coward. I'd stay here. I have 2 young children who need me around, so I can't be taking trips to Mars. I don't imagine he's going to ask us either.
It's a fun book, I'm told, but you had to read how many books in order to get the research in order to do it?
We have 26 shelves on our bookshelves, 26 rows on our bookshelves of books that we read and PDFs on our computers. It was 4 years of intense research.
Wow, Kelly Weiner-Smith, thank you very much indeed. And Zach, thank you for coming outside your house in Virginia to talk to us. We'll let you go back, maybe get some sleep, perhaps. That's good of you to talk to us, and many congratulations on winning that prize.